Brilliance Audio presents Nameless, Season 2, a collection of Amazon original stories by Dean Koontz, performed by Eduardo Ballerini. The Lost Soul of the City. 1. Every night lacks a moon and stars. Dawn always comes without the sun. Wind never blows, and rain never falls. Here there is no robin's song, no trees where birds might roost, no sky through which they might fly. These windowless rooms spare Spencer Wooten from the sight of a world he despises. He has put filters on the overhead light panels, softening their fluorescent glare. But sometimes he prefers candlelight. At the moment, the pulsing of a score of lambent flames paints the walls of his study with radiant shapes and shifting shadows, like contesting spirits engaged in the eternal battle of good and evil. Of course, Spencer knows that neither good nor evil exists, only what is logical and illogical. With a bachelor's degree in the study of the literature of the illiterate, a master's degree in creative deconstruction, and a second master's in crafting reality, he is keenly aware of the profound ignorance of the masses and the danger they pose by their stubborn insistence that life has meaning. Meaning is the enemy of happiness. Those paranoid yet optimistic fools who constructed this place had stocked one room with 20,000 pounds of candles cached in metal drums to be used after the public power supply failed, and the hundreds of propane tanks for the backup generator were empty. Through no fault of their own, the apocalypse never came. They were idiots. In Spencer's estimation, most people are idiots. He has only contempt for them. The great unwashed think that contempt is an unworthy emotion, when in fact contempt, even more than envy, is essential if those who share his philosophy are ever to build a better world in which retaliatory injustice is the only justice, and truth is always and only what enlightened leaders say it is. Sometimes, as now, holding a candlestick on which a taper is impaled on a pricket, the melting wax collecting in a brass drip pan, Spencer wanders the chambers of this redoubt. In such light, mystery layers its vaults and corridors, a sense that here the seeds of the future wait to grow, that as master of this realm, he will be a grand historic figure 100 years from now. One of the largest rooms contains freeze-dried food in sealed canisters, enough to feed 50 people for a decade. Its shelf life is 40 years, and it is replaced every 30. The idiots who built the place are long dead. A new idiot now regularly supplies it. Only 28, Spencer Augie Wooten hadn't been around when the world was supposed to end with the United States and the Soviet Union unloading thousands of hydrogen bombs. He wishes they had. Only catastrophe can bring about radical change for the better. By the time that he was a college sophomore, Spencer wanted to be president, so that he might control a nuclear arsenal that could be turned on those millions of his compatriots in flyover country who were too stupid or too selfish to strive for the changes that must occur. However, becoming president requires decades of ingratiating oneself with the moronic, amoral types who need to be liquidated, which is too tedious a career path to pursue. He's resigned to being an unassuming agent of change, setting little fires wherever he can, feeding the chaos by destroying a bank here, a neighborhood grocery there, a Starbucks anywhere. Ironically, his living quarters and workplace provide him with a degree of security and peace conducive to devising imaginative acts of violence. His contribution to the destruction of the current civilization might eventually be less humble than he now believes. As is always the case during his wandering, he pauses the longest in the arsenal, surveying the weapons with a quiet ecstasy. The Beatles were a regressive band making music that, for the most part, should be purged from the culture. But they had it right when they sang, "Happiness is a warm gun." Here are handguns, and shotguns, and rifles, sound suppressors for pistols, airtight steel ammunition cans packed full of hollow-point rounds with full metal jackets. If all of this were, in one day, put into the hands of a few thousand bold individuals with the right sense of history, the city's streets would run with blood, and this corrupt civilization would begin to fall. Instead, the stock in the arsenal is treated as the inventory of a business, sold in bulk to mere criminals who will chip away at the foundation of society and gradually weaken it toward a collapse at some future time. That is the theory behind selling thousands of weapons a year to gangbangers and other thugs. Let those nihilists prepare the way, so when the true revolutionaries make their move, the system will be easily destroyed. Spencer understands this approach, but he can't bring himself to approve of it. He yearns for the Sturm und Drang of mass terror. Nevertheless, once a week he ascends to the Shafthead, where he collects the orders for weapons and ammunition that have been left by an intermediary he's never met. He packages what is wanted and loads it into whatever transport has been provided. On some occasions, an ambulance. Other times, an armored truck, like those that deliver money to banks, or a van apparently belonging to the power company. Always a vehicle that neither local police nor federal agents will find suspicious. City and state authorities have long thought that the high rate of gun violence is the fault of black market merchants driving gun shipments in from surrounding states, though they can never catch them. They can't catch them because that's not how it's done. Although the poison is being dripped into the system rather than injected in massive doses, he takes some solace in the certainty that a significant number of these guns are going to other metropolitan areas. And because they are superb counterfeits, Glock, Smith & Wesson, Heckler & Koch knockoffs, manufactured in the most foreign of foreign countries, they are untraceable. Sometimes, late in the evening when a few glasses of good wine have mellowed him, he wishes that he could have an album of photos of all the people killed with guns he has provided. He would enjoy paging through such a collection. In the absence of an album, he has nothing as arousing, only porno DVDs. Though they get the job done. 2. Nameless stands at a second-floor window, drinking coffee, reviewing the dangers of the day ahead, which include the storm. Nature can be as deadly as the human beings she has spawned, though she can't match them for cruelty, because she is a green machine without emotions. Sometimes winter comes to this city as early as November, although seldom with the fury expected of this year's initial storm. Dawn brings a wind that scours the littered streets and forces the homeless to retreat to neighborhoods where burned-out storefronts, left unrepaired after recent riots, offer shelter from the cold. The sky looks as hard and white as a slab of ice, but the snow has not yet begun to fall. He arrived the previous evening in a Ford Explorer registered to an international NGO called Peace Forever, which exists only on paper. He often carries no ID, though in this case he has a driver's license in the name of Ricardo de Verdad. That is not his true name. He doesn't remember his real name, for his identity is entombed behind a wall of engineered amnesia. His recollections are limited to the many missions that he has undertaken during the past 26 months. He is grateful for this forgetfulness, for he suspects, intuits, knows, that in his shrouded past are memories that might destroy him. Nameless doesn't know who blessed him with this amnesia, or with what technology it was accomplished, although they must be the same people who assign him to his missions and supply everything he needs to fulfill them. Often he stays in a hotel booked for him and paid in advance by his handler, known only as Ace of Diamonds. Who Ace might be, What Ace might be, he doesn't know. They have never spoken, communicating only by text messages on his current smartphone, which he always destroys after his mission is accomplished. This time, however, his target is a man so powerful, and with such control of this metropolis, that Nameless is keeping a lower profile than usual. These days, most hotel security teams photograph guests surreptitiously on check-in and keep those images on file, a resource that the city's ruling clique might well exploit in the aftermath of this operation. He is occupying a once-proud row house in a neighborhood of abandoned structures, 3 blocks square, slated to be bulldozed to make way for a sports arena financed by taxpayers for the benefit of team owners and the politicians they bribe so generously. Although no one occupies the more than 200 other buildings, certain liability issues require that public services be maintained until the final condemnation notices are issued. He has all the comforts of home, while living in what might as well be a ghost town. These blocks are fenced off from all traffic. He has been provided with a remote control to the motorized chain-link gates, so that he can drive freely to and from this safe house. The Explorer is tucked out of sight in a one-car garage at the back of the property. As he finishes the coffee in his mug, the wind abruptly relents, as if it is a theater curtain opening to reveal the stage. In the sudden stillness, the show begins. The first feathery flakes descend in gentle spirals. In its beginning, either a profound change in the weather or a revolution can seem to have a tender intent. However, every storm is ultimately a violent event. He loathes violence, although he is good at it. Unlike those he has come here to confront, he's not a bloodthirsty revolutionary, ignorantly convinced that justice is one and the same thing for all times and all places. Shaped and misshapen by culture and politics and other forces, justice is too plastic a concept to inspire righteous action. Instead, Nameless is committed to the discovery and defense of truth. Because truth is always and only what it is, the sole reliable light through this funhouse world of deception. He has slept well, and is ready for the unpleasantness that's coming. He needs no alarm clock, because he always goes to sleep within a minute of putting his head on the pillow, and he always wakes at the time that he selected before switching off the bedside lamp. Like amnesia, this is one of the gifts that his unknown benefactors have given him. Having drunk the last of his coffee, he sets the empty mug on the windowsill and prepares for the day's work. When he arrived, his weapon was waiting for him in the pantry, in an empty tin of butter cookies, a 5-round Smith & Wesson's Chief Special, chambered for the .357 Magnum. In the absence of cookies, were also 4 speed loaders providing another 20 rounds. This operation is expected to require neither automatic weapons nor much ammunition. Ace of Diamonds, and whoever else plans these missions, have proven to be reliable strategists and tacticians. Otherwise, Nameless would have been dead a long time ago. He holsters the gun and shrugs into a lightweight, quilted, hooded jacket. He puts 2 speed loaders in each zippered pocket. He slips his arms through the straps of a small backpack, the kind of book bag favored by high school students. If he were going to be outdoors for an extended period of time, he would be inadequately dressed for the blizzard now crystallizing the metropolis. However, for the most part, he will not be in the city, but under it, the colossal weight of its structures and its corruption bearing down on him. Frequently, Nameless works alone, although this time he has a partner, James Freeman, whom he has never met. This individual is not one of the operatives who work with Ace, but an outsider, a local, which is unusual. When a partner is needed, Ace has always paired Nameless with in-house agents. James Freeman has recommended this condemned neighborhood as a safe home base. Ace of Diamonds' text messages about the man have seemed a bit coy. Nameless intuits that there will be a surprise of some kind when they meet. 3. After a brief silence, the wind is howling again, as though this is a post-apocalyptic world without human beings, where wolves have reclaimed the city. The snowflakes, once big and soft, are now small and icy, whipping through the streets in torrents. The iron drain gate is in an alley that was busy back in the day when commerce thrived here. Currently, though this is still an inhabited neighborhood, you can kill someone, take 15 minutes at it, with little risk of being apprehended by the police. For most of his life, Jimmy Freeman has expected to be killed, either slowly or by a bullet in the head. If someone tries again to waste him, they tried twice before, he hopes it won't be a headshot, because he wants to look respectable in death, which is hard to do when your face is racked and jacked by a high-caliber hollow-point round. Besides, even if you're tied up and tied down, with three meth freaks eager to take turns cutting off slices of your pecker with straight razors, you can still have hope, a chance, as long as your brain works and you haven't bled out. All Jimmy has ever wanted is a chance. He's had a few, but never a big one. He's only 16, however, so he has a little time to catch some luck. He believes in luck, although he knows that he's a lot more likely to step in the bad kind than fall into the good kind. He even believes in grace, which comes from God. But lately he suspects that God seldom traffics with this city anymore. Jimmy Freeman has been going underground since he was 10 years old, when he realized that he needed to save himself from all those people who wanted to break him and change him, those bullying street bosses and schoolyard pushers and scammers who have no use for a kid who wants to be someone different from them. They envy him for his dreams and resent him for doing well in school. They mock him for obeying his mother, who's afflicted with multiple sclerosis and works from home as a bookkeeper for two chiropractors. She makes him swear to stay away from the gangs, and he does, though turning them down ensures that he's their target. They don't think much of women in the first place, and a sickly woman is an object of special scorn. They say that no real man would let such a weak bitch tell him what to do. Jimmy wants to be the kind of man who earns that title not merely by being of a certain age, but by doing what is right. In his free time, when he is exploring the world below the city, he never encounters gang members who would co-opt or kill him. Now, crouched in the deserted alleyway, he lifts one end of the iron grate from the drain. He slides that heavy item aside and eels into the 3-foot-diameter vertical pipe, which is 5 feet from top to bottom. Standing bent-kneed in a small catch basin full of paper and plastic debris, he pulls the grate into place overhead. Such pale wintry beams pass through the slots in the grate that Jimmy might as well be in absolute darkness. A tack light is clipped to his belt, but he doesn't need it here. He doesn't suffer from either claustrophobia or a fear of the dark. Thin, lithe, and well-practiced in the techniques of urban spelunking, he sits on the lip of the catch basin, legs extended into an adjoining culvert that slopes down to the large main storm drain serving this sector. This passage is the same diameter as the vertical pipe by which he entered. He can squirm through it on his belly, but he eases forward until he is lying on his back. Palms flat against the curve that encircles him, he thrusts forward. Years of storm runoff have smoothed this concrete. No rain has fallen in a few days, but the undercity is by nature always slightly damp. Condensation facilitates his slide along maybe 15 feet of culvert. This tributary terminates 7 feet above the floor of a main storm drain, a tunnel 12 feet in diameter. As if passing through a birth canal, Jimmy Freeman is born from narrow darkness into a bigger darkness. He slips down the curved wall of the large drain to stand in what seems like the perfect silence of the grave. Gradually he becomes aware of the subtle noises that translate through the concrete and bedrock on which the city stands. The muted rumble of trains, the faint rhythmic laboring of what might be the pumps that keep water supplied to the populace. He unclips the tack light from his belt and switches it on and plays the beam over the mottled walls. There are no bats here, as he once feared. The alligators of urban legend are nowhere to be found. The cool air is somewhat dank, but not unpleasant. These aren't sewers. They're storm drains, flooded and washed clean by the drenching rains to which this waterside city is often subjected. Because rats feed on cockroaches, among other things, and because there's nothing here for the bugs to eat, there are no roaches, and rarely rodents. In fact, over the 6 years since he first descended into this underworld, the streets above have become dirtier and more littered than these drainways, and more violent. The deterioration of the city makes him determined somehow to earn enough money to relocate to a safe, clean, quiet town. Recently, his determination has been twined with growing desperation. But now he has a chance, a bit of good luck. A chance can be wasted, and good luck can turn bad. But not this time. Not this time. He is going to buy a better life for his mom and a brighter future for himself. This mammoth drain, wide enough to drive through, always makes him acutely conscious of what challenges the builders of the city met over generations and of what wonders they accomplished. These subterranean passageways usually remind him that he is a boy of little experience, small and powerless. On this occasion, however, he feels taller and stronger. From books and movies, he knows the city used to be a magical place, vibrant, glamorous. The magic that once made its towers shine has worn away, though perhaps, like the dust of ages, the magic has settled down here, where now he breathes it in and is empowered by it. Many smaller drains open high in the walls of this main line, all unmarked. But the source of each tributary large enough to admit maintenance teams is identified by a sign made of black and white tiles inlaid in the concrete. North Avenue, Grand Avenue. Jimmy Freeman is so familiar with this undercity that he doesn't need the signs to guide him. With only the flashlight, he can find his way to that three-block square neighborhood that has been condemned for a new sports arena. His fortune waits there. 4. Nameless does not lower his head in defense against the storm. The icy air and skirling wind are energizing, and he is inspired by this neighborhood, an ethnic enclave that once bustled with people leading meaningful lives. The sterile office skyscrapers and the expensive high-rise residential towers stand at a distance. Screened by thick skeins of wind-blown snow, those soaring structures seem unreal, like a mirage of a city extending a promise of glamour that it will never fulfill. By contrast, these row houses and humble standalone homes, in spite of the similarities in their design and ornamentation, are rich with character. Through his mind flicker vivid scenes. These streets as they once were when children played here, and neighbors visited one another on their stoops and porches, when workmen came home at day's end with their lunch pails, when families in their Sunday dress walked to church. The images that he sees are neither works of his imagination nor memories. They are intense moments of clairvoyance. One of his abilities, over which he has no control, is receiving visions of the past or future, involving his life or the lives of others. These are often brief fragments, or else long montages of fragments, the meaning of which he sometimes can't discern until it's too late. He is the product of weird science beyond his understanding. But because the clairvoyance is imperfect, he suspects it as a side effect that his handlers did not anticipate. Now he comes to a corner grocery, abandoned like everything else in this redevelopment zone. The sign announces Antonello's. Once family businesses like this were the heart of America, but there seem to be fewer of them every year. As he approaches the front door of the grocery, where he is to meet James Freeman, he halts when everything around him abruptly changes. Morning becomes sunset. The waning day suddenly lacks snow. In the crimson light of the sinking sun, the condemned buildings have ceased to exist. Blocks away as the sky darkens, the most recently built office towers are among those thrusting high into the twilight. Therefore, this is not a clairvoyant glimpse of the past. However, there is no sports arena as depicted on the billboard above the chain-link gate by which he arrived here the previous night. Instead, he is surrounded by drab two-story structures that resemble cell blocks in a prison camp. Some parapeted roofs feature gun emplacements ringed by razor wire. Two men appear and hurry past, oblivious of Nameless. They wear black uniforms and polished black boots, and they carry pistols and belt holsters. On each man's coat sleeve, below his shoulder, is a patch bearing a Triskelion. A white circle encloses three muscular red arms that radiate from the center, joined at the shoulders to form a wheel that suggests unstoppable momentum. Each arm is bent at the elbow, and each hand is fisted, symbolizing power, and the red is no doubt an endorsement of bloody violence. In the near distance, a woman screams, a shrill expression of such terror and despair that Nameless is chilled to the marrow. Then other men, women, and children cry out, protesting some outrage or fate that is revealed when the camp rattles with machine gun fire that silences the voices. The vision folds away, like an origami flower shriveling into a bud of paper, into a seed. The truth of the city in winter returns. Emotionally shaken, physically shaking, Nameless doesn't know if what he has seen is an inevitable totalitarian future, or only one possibility toward which the country is moving. Because of his success at bringing the hammer of truth down on those whom the system has failed to prosecute, because he forces on them the consequences of their evil, he wonders if his missions are preludes to some greater task of an importance so profound that he can't imagine it. Always, and again now, he turns his mind away from that question, because it is too daunting to dwell upon. The pneumatic glass door of Antonella's grocery must have had sufficient value to warrant being removed and taken elsewhere as the business vacated the premises. Where it once stood is a plywood wall with a crude temporary man-sized door. It's locked. He zippers open his jacket and unclips a police lock-release gun from his belt. He inserts the automatic pick in the keyway and pulls the trigger a few times, until all the pins are kicked to the shear line. With the wolfish wind howling at his back and snow spitting past him in a rabid foam, he steps into a darkness where generations of a family worked hard and served their neighbors and lived their dream until everything was taken away from them by the city. 5. After a pleasant tour of the arsenal, Spencer Wooten travels farther into his subterranean kingdom. He passes through an immense kitchen with a bewildering collection of culinary equipment that is hooked up to public power but is meant to operate for 6 months on electricity provided by the propane-fueled generators after the city's utility companies are obliterated in the ultimate crisis. Supposing that Armageddon comes, the political elites and their younger consorts who might shelter here would most likely find that freeze-dried food, even reconstituted with water, is grim fare. They are not ordinary grifters, but grifters of refined sensibilities, accustomed to the best of everything. Meatless hamburger powder mixed with water, formed into patties and cooked in the flames of candles, won't satisfy those eminences accustomed to dining on filet mignon, considering that each of them is without a conscience and is an omnivore with a bottomless appetite for all things. If they ever occupy this place, it will be only a matter of time before they eat one another, the most exotic form of steak tartare. The candles emit such a rich scent of roses that it is cloying. Maybe the manufacturer accidentally infused the wax with too much attar of roses and sold them as rejects at cost. That is unlikely, for those who run the city seldom seek value for the public's money, and they always provide the best of everything for themselves. The order for 10 tons of candles perhaps specified that they must be unscented, but the wrong stock had been shipped. Frequently our mistakes turn out to suggest meaning beyond the fact that we have made an error. Roses, and the scent of them, have numerous symbolic associations, some so disturbing that Spencer Wooten chooses not to consider them. The floors of this deep, sprawling domain are white porcelain tile. The concrete walls are painted a pale yellow in many rooms, sky blue or soft pink in others, just enough color and variety of hues to inspire a positive mood without suggesting the shrieking palette of a daycare facility designed by a manic clown. By the light of the reeking candle, he arrives at a steel door that, in spite of its great weight, swings open easily on pivot hinges. Beyond lies the cremation room. As befits its purpose, this is a stark chamber. The porcelain tile is white as elsewhere, but no paint has been applied to the walls. The power pack cremation system can reduce a human being to an urnful of fine ashes and a few fragments of bone in as little as 2 hours. Back in the day, the city officials who intended to retreat here on the brink of nuclear war had realized they might have to wait years for radiation on the surface to subside. During that time, some of them might die. Corpses couldn't just be left lying around to rot. Cremation was the sole solution. The system vents to the surface through ductwork that makes a series of right-angle turns equipped with radiation filters. The smoke from the burning corpse emerges little noticed in the garbage of a smoldering landfill. Originally, tanks of propane powered the cremator. But after the Soviet Union collapsed and the threat of nuclear war diminished, the system was converted to natural gas for more efficient peacetime operation. A few times a year, Spencer's mentor, Michael McGinty, 58, president of the city council, who operates the mayor as if she's a marionette and the governor as if he's a mere hand puppet, sends Spencer a corpse that needs to vanish, avoiding the risk of an autopsy. Just the previous night, Spencer burned Cassandra Pollock, an 18-year-old girl who had overestimated her value as a street companion to McGinty. She attempted extortion, intending to leverage more for herself than McGinty was willing to give. McGinty claims to be a revolutionary who presents himself to the public as a moderate solely for the purpose of deceiving them into electing him. He says he's always hopeful that he can have a major role in the destruction of the current order. Spencer Wooten suspects that McGinty might be only an armchair revolutionary who likes his pleasures too much ever to embrace the chaos required to destroy the existing order in which he thrives. After all, he's been in city politics for 36 years and has done nothing truly heroic, such as blow up a courthouse or firebomb a church. This is a terminally sick society. If even one's beloved mentor can't be trusted to live by his principles. Spencer carries his candle to a nearby cabinet and takes from a shelf the mason jar that contains Cassie Pollock's remains. The bone fragments that survived are in a box in his bedroom. He has a hobby of creating intricate works of scrimshaw from the pieces of the dead that are at least the size of his thumb. He has hesitated to dispose of the girl's ashes. When holding the jar containing her, Spencer vividly remembers the pleasure of processing her corpse. Because she'd been smothered with a pillow, there had been no grievous wounds to disfigure her. As she reposed naked on the gurney from which she would be slid into the consuming flames, her perfect body had glowed with the reflected firelight from the open door of the cremator. So she appeared to be a sleeping princess in a fairy tale. In the outpouring of heat from the system, she'd been warm to the touch. For a brief time, his alone to admire. If the day comes when the city above is nuked, Spencer will be required to resort to a chemical toilet. Currently, the availability of city water and functional plumbing will allow him to flush these ashes. He has done so with the remains of others, but he is loath to deal with Cassie as if she is sewage. Although he knew her for such a short time, she is special to him. She inspires an affection he has never known for anyone else. In the past, he was drawn to women who shared his Jacobin ideology, but no relationship evolved with any of them. They are perpetually, fiercely angry about the imperfect nature of the human species, as is Spencer. His anger and theirs inevitably compound into a mutual rage and bitterness, ensuring that affection is no more likely between them than between a tarantula and a scorpion. Copulation doesn't appeal to him, except for Cassandra and those nymphs in dreams, intimately touching a woman, repulses him. Loneliness is the fate of he who dares to change the world. He must be satisfied with the romance of violence and destruction. Nevertheless, in a moment of sentimentality, he returns the jar of Cassandra's ashes to the cabinet, once again sparing her from the indignity of the toilet. 6. Having closed the grocery store door behind him, Nameless moves quickly sideways in the darkness of the abandoned building, his back against a wall. He stops, waits. He is 40 minutes early. Although the man he's here to meet was vetted by Ace of Diamonds, it's always wise in such a situation to be the first to arrive, just in case the other doesn't come alone as he has been instructed. Nameless is not a superhero with extraordinary senses. He can't see in the dark or hear a heart beating on the far side of a room. However, his intuition is as good as anyone's, and better than most. Within a minute, he senses that he shares this place with someone. He tries to listen through the keening wind that punishes the world outside, but the presence he intuits is as silent as Nameless. If he switches on a flashlight, he makes a target of himself. Because no one can get a fix on his position from a few spoken words, he says, "James?" After a hesitation, the other switches on a flashlight.
"People call me Jimmy."
Although Nameless expects a surprise, he isn't ready for a shock like this. "You're just a kid."
"I'm 16.
"Isn't that what I said?" Revealed in the backwash of the light, Jimmy Freeman has short hair, a face for the movies, and a defiant but not angry expression.
"I'm going to be part of this. I'm the one who discovered it."
On these missions, Nameless sometimes rescues children in dire circumstances. He leads them out of danger, not into it, never into it, not knowingly. The thought of being responsible for this boy fills him with dread, with a fear that Jimmy will die while in his care. The intensity of this feeling is out of proportion to the moment, so that perhaps the emotion that shakes him is an omen of sorts, a warning of a loss to come, or a reminder of some loss he's already incurred in the years behind the shroud of amnesia. In spite of the importance of the mission, he hesitates. "I can't." Not in a contentious tone, but quietly and calmly, the boy says,
"I've been promised something big, and I'm going to earn it. That was the deal. It's still the deal."
Nameless considers his unlikely partner. "Promised what?"
"A mortgage-free house for my mom, in a nice town that hasn't gone to hell. $100,000 to set up a bookkeeping service."
"What do you know about bookkeeping?"
"What my mom taught me. It'll be her business, but I can help. I'm good with numbers."
"What about your dad?"
"He's been dead 11 years.
"How'd he die?"
"Hard. Shot 5 times.
Freeman's voice is purged of emotion. "Who did it?" Nameless asks.
"Everyone pretends not to know. They say maybe a gang hit."
"That makes sense to you?"
"He was a barber, not a gangbanger. A barber.
Could have been an initiation killing." The boy nods.
"To prove to the gang you got stones."
"It's always an innocent. A barber, a child."
600 murdered here last year. 22 little kids."
"This is about more than your dad."
"It's not right for anyone to have to live in fear this way."
"Your anger is greater than your fear, but you hide it well." Freeman says nothing. "Do you just hide it well?" Nameless asks. "Or do you really have it under control?"
"I'm not a hothead. I don't want blood, just what's right."
"What's your definition of right?"
"Whoever pulled the trigger isn't the only one to blame."
Although he intuits the answer, Nameless asks, "Who else?"
"Those who run the city. They don't care about us."
"Us being who?"
"Any of us who aren't in their crowd, their little circle."
"You think this is a race thing?"
"No. They're all colors themselves, and the only color that matters to any of them is green."
"It's money," Nameless agrees. "Always follow the money. But it's also power." The boy understands.
"Telling other people what to do, what we can have, what we can be, what we can think, It gets them off. It's the same thing that the gangbangers get off on. The wind shrieks a threnody through the dead neighborhood and away through an impending graveyard of high-rise tombstones.
You have a gun? Amos asks.
No.
True?
I don't lie. I'm sick of lies.
Just understand, I have the only gun we'll need.
Let's hope so, the boy says. Nameless wants to know how the story this kid has to tell must have come to the attention of Ace of Diamonds. However, if he asks, he'll have to explain that he doesn't know who Ace is or what organization conceives his missions, which is not likely to inspire the kid's confidence in him.
One more thing, Jimmy Freeman. A house for your mom, money to start a business for her. But what's in this for you?
Her being safe is all.
Another town might be safer, but nowhere is totally safe in this world. Not anymore.
Okay, then safer. That's something anyway. She's a widow, and now she's in a wheelchair, struggled all her life to put food on the table. And I've never heard her complain, not once. She deserves whatever better she can get. His voice breaks. He clears his throat and says, "She deserves better than the best."
Nameless meets the kid's stare in silence for a long moment. There's no cleaner motive than love. Jimmy Freeman doesn't reply. But in the backwash of the flashlight beam, his eyes shine with unshed tears. "I'm going to take a chance on you," Nameless says. "Even young as you are, maybe you have the right stuff." "Do you have the right stuff, Jimmy Freeman?"
After a hesitation, the kid says, "Maybe. I don't know. I guess we'll find out."
Nameless smiles. "That's what I hoped you'd say." 7. Speedo and Point Man cruise through the storm in the flat black Caddy Escalade, like maybe they're music stars getting loose and easy for a gig that night. But they're just violence junkies looking for trouble, which is harder to find with so few people out in the freezing wind. The Lade has big tires with deep tread and all-wheel drive, so it can chew its way through hard weather of any kind. Behind the wheel, Speedo says,
"The city? She used to be one tough bitch."
Point Man says, "What city?"
"What's the only city I ever known? This city, Peckerbrain."
"She's still tough, all right. She got steel tits."
"What trash you talking? The city don't got no tits."
"She got 'em if she's a bitch. You call her a bitch."
Speedo sighs.
"What I'm saying is, like, was a time no blizzard could shut the city down."
Looking at his Rolex, Point Man says, "What time is that?"
"Not any damn time today, asswipe. I'm talking time like in the past, the way she used to be."
"I got no interest in the past. I'm about the future."
"Yeah, what future you about?"
"Getting to where I'm the dog of dogs."
Amazed, Speedo says,
"That ain't no future. That's a fantasy."
"I got a plan. Anyway, most it takes to be the dog of dogs is meanness. I got more meanness than anyone's got."
"What meanness you got if I can call you Peckerbrain asswipe and I still got a tongue in my mouth?"
"That's just your way, Speedo. I know you don't mean nothing by it. But some shithead thinks he's king forever, like Dr. Zed or Wolfpack. They diss me. It'll be different. I'll send their cut-off dicks to their mamas with sorry for your lost condiment cards."
"Not condiment, condolence. Man, you ever get stupid enough to make a move on Dr. Zed or Wolfpack, give me a warning so I can be in China when it goes down."
"What's in China?"
"Not you and not them."
Leaning forward, squinting through the smears that the ice-crusted wipers leave on the windshield, Point Man says,
"Where's the salt trucks and plows? It's gonna be another mess like last winter."
"Ain't that what I've been saying?"
"Sometimes I don't got no clue what you're saying."
Again, Speedo sighs.
"Well, that's the sad truth."
"Don't matter to us. This Lade can smash through any shit thrown at it."
He leans farther forward.
"What the fuck? You see this? Ahead? Other side the fence?"
Speedo sees it. Past the chain link, on the sidewalk in front of the condemned row houses, two guys hurry along. Bent into the wind, one big, one smaller. The big guy's dressed in fancy-ass high-end gear, blue or black like a man ought to want it, quilted and with a hood. The jerk-off with him wears a winterized yellow hoodie even brighter than the cotton hoodie that he wears in warm weather.
Is it him?
Speeda wonders. Who else wears yellow pussy gear? I never seen no fool wear one but Jimmy Freeman. He does it to diss us. His way of saying he ain't ever gonna be one of us.
That guy's about the right size for Jimmy.
Slow down so they don't see us. What are they up to, in there where it's all just gonna get bulldozed?
They got some kind of action going,
Speedo says. What action? Salvaging doorknobs and toilet paper holders?
Something about the big guy looks serious. How he moves. He ain't in there rescuing cats what got left behind. They're up to something. Maybe we got competition.
We never had no competition this side of town, but the Dr. Zed didn't feed the fools their own cut-out eyes.
There's always some new clown posse thinks it's gonna rule.
Beyond the fence, the big guy and the Freeman fool leave the sidewalk and disappear between detached houses. Speedo pulls the Escalade to the curb.
We got an opportunity. We find a secret operation Zed needs to crush. We're gonna move up the dog ladder.
Dog ladder? What's a dog ladder?
You started the dog thing, Speedo says. Not me.
Dogs can't climb no ladder. If we got ourselves a chance here, it's maybe we can move from back of the pack to the middle.
So let's go,
Speedo says, opening the driver's door and getting out of the SUV. The cold air bites, and the wind howls. It's a dog day. Point Man goes to the back of the vehicle, raises the lift gate, throws aside the floor mat, pops the lid on the recessed space that contains the spare tire, and retrieves 33-round magazines for the Glock 18 full-auto pistols that he and Speedo carry in shoulder rigs. These guns are for VIP protection teams. But in this city, gangbangers consider themselves very important persons, and they are treated as such. Point Man keeps 2 magazines and gives another pair to Speedo. Each man now has 99 rounds if he needs them. On this quiet street, with the weather deteriorating, there's little traffic. Speedo waits until a Lincoln Navigator churns past, spewing up a thin wake of clotted snow. When no vehicle is in sight, he and Point Man scale the chain link and drop into the condemned neighborhood beyond. The wind is busy scouring the footprints from the thin layer of snow on the sidewalk, but the tracks are clear enough to allow the swift pursuit of Jimmy Freeman and his unknown partner. 8. On the second Wednesday of each month, Michael Mickey McGinty descends from his throne as president of the city council and spends a few hours in the bunker, a place that proves to him there is nothing true about the faith in which his parents raised him. If there were angels on the earth, a choir of saints in heaven, and God above, McGinty would not be allowed to prosper for a lifetime and receive punishment only after dying. A righteous God would make sure that he suffers some negative consequence in this life for the way he's conducted himself since he became an eager materialist at 17. He is a liar, a thief, an embezzler, a rapist. He has murdered men during his climb to power, and after arriving at his current position, he contracted with others to commit murder for him. Just the previous evening, he smothered Cassandra Pollock with a pillow. Yet he's in good health, richer than ever, admired by many and respected by most, and feared by everyone. Mayors and governors come and go, but the president of the council can hold office for life if he's smart and ruthless. The money he makes from the business in the bunker does not contribute greatly to Mickey McGinty's net worth. Ostensibly, he lives in a modest house in a middle-class neighborhood of the city. However, through various LLCs and trusts, he owns a fine oceanfront estate in Hawaii, another in Florida, a 420-acre ranch in Idaho, and another estate in a South American country that has no extradition treaty with the United States. Clever embezzlement of public funds and a river of bribes are complemented by the money that is donated to the McGinty Cares Foundation. That tax-free charity brings in a reliable $25 million each year, spends $2 million per annum on caring for unwed mothers, spends $3 million on expenses incurred by the McGinty family during their selfless management of it, and leaks the rest into the many bank accounts over which Mickey has control under one name or another. The money produced by operations in the bunker is chump change. He wants it nonetheless. Anyway, the primary purpose of the bunker is not to be another income stream, but to be a fountain of social disruption, spewing chaos throughout the city. Experienced leaders like Mickey know how to exploit chaos to make their power grow. So this Wednesday morning, he's looking forward to his monthly descent when a woman calling herself Portia Pollock arrives at his offices without an appointment. After brazening her way through the vestibule, she's halted by security when she comes to the desk of Bridget Hastings, Mickey's formidable secretary, in the reception lounge outside his office. Alerted to this, Mickey watches video of the confrontation on his computer screen. At 39, Portia resembles Cassandra, who is now ashes. She doesn't mention a daughter, but insists that she's a relative of Councilman McGinty, a relative by marriage, and that he'll want to see her. She is a force of nature, with whom Mickey must reckon, and quickly. Because the woman isn't carrying a purse, and has been scoped by security electronics that have revealed neither a gun nor a knife, McGinty opens his office door, surprising both the two security men and Bridget Hastings.
"Portia! Why didn't you tell me you were going to be in the city? Does Samantha know? She didn't mention it to me."
Samantha is his wife, whom he neither loves nor hates. She is the only person in this world who scares him. Though not because he fears she'll kill him if she finds out that he screws around. She knows about his other women, and encourages his adultery so he'll have no energy left to put his hands on her. However, Samantha expects that a nickel of Mickey's every dime is hers. If he dares to short her, he'll wake one night to find her with a switchblade in one hand and his privates in the other.
"I wanted to surprise you," Portia Pollock says. "I know how much you've always liked surprises. It's the little boy in you."
As she passes him on her way into his office, she pinches his cheek. He tells Bridget to hold all calls and closes the door. With her back to him, Portia Pollock is at the big window with a spectacular view of the city. He stands beside her, gazing out at the metropolis awash in snow.
"Where's my daughter?" the woman asks.
"She led me to believe we were each other's secret.
She tells me everything. She didn't call last night after she saw you. She always calls me. Don't think you can sweet-talk her into staying with you. She can be stupidly romantic, impractical, but that's not how it's going to be. You've got me to deal with, not her. What kind of man are you? Seducing an innocent girl, 17 when you first had her, young enough to be your granddaughter."
This is not the approach of a worried mother. McGinty doesn't play anyone's game. He maneuvers them into playing his. She wants him to be embarrassed and worried, to justify himself. How foolish she is to think that he feels the need to justify anything he does.
"What kind of a man am I? The kind Cassandra couldn't resist. If she was 17 then, she's 18 now, old enough. What kind of mother are you, gossiping with your daughter about her lovers?"
His boldness surprises her. She turns to face him.
"So you admit having an affair with her when she was still a minor?"
"It was never an affair, Portia. She might be romantic, but I've no time for that. I used her for a while, and used her hard. That's all. And now I've sent her off for an abortion."
This woman is tough, not given to displays of emotion, but her face hardens at his callous response.
"You're a disgusting pig."
He smiles and shakes his head.
"I won't contest your judgment. You've obviously had much experience of disgusting pigs."
She'd arrived with an air of confidence, accustomed to getting what she wanted, unable to imagine any way out of this confrontation other than the one she mapped. She thought that he'd quail from the charge that he'd seduced a minor. She's rattled by his fearless response, by his contempt for her and Cassandra. If she'd come here with the expectation of extorting a fat payoff, she was worried now. This time, with genuine concern, she says,
"Where's my daughter? Where's Cassandra?"
"I told you I sent her away for an abortion. I'm sure you were aware that she was pregnant. In fact, Portia, low-life trash that you are, I've no doubt that the two of you schemed this together, her lying about being on the pill."
She reverts to the brazen harridan she was when she arrived.
"Tell me where she is now, you bastard, or I'll go to the police."
He snatches her right hand before she can step back from him, brings it to his lips, kisses it. Dear lady, I'm about to give you the best advice you've ever received. Tomorrow a man will offer you 30% less than your condominium is worth. Sell it to him. Sell it cheap, and take the other $236,000 you have in the bank. How could you know how much? How could I not? Take the money from the bank before I decide to have a clever hacker steal it for me. With the condo proceeds, you'll have over $625,000. Pack your things as quickly as you can and move far from the city, someplace where no one knows you ever had a daughter, where you'll never have to explain her absence if maybe she chooses not to come back to you. You're enough of a looker to drain some hapless son of a bitch of everything he has. You'll do all right. This is a dangerous world, Portia. So much crime. So many innocent people caught up in gang shootings every year, and so few murders solved. Find a more peaceful place to live. Grieve if you must, but then get on with life. Her eyes fill with unspilled tears, perhaps more for herself than for Cassandra. She is shaking, her fear undisguised. When he releases her hand, she makes a fist against her heart. She says, "What? Dry your tears now," he advises. "When you leave, you must appear to be what you claimed to be when you barged in here. A relative by marriage, an old friend who stopped by for a chat." She tries again.
"What? What are you?"
"What are you, Portia? What is any of us? We are creatures of endless wants and needs, driven by greed and lust and love of power. Most of you live by one lie or another. The difference with me is that I know what I am, and have no need to pretend to myself I'm something else, though I'm a master of pretending to all of you." 9. Although Nameless has received a detailed recorded briefing of his mission, it has failed to prepare him for the eerie grandeur of the city's underworld, which had been heroically engineered and masterfully constructed, and until recent decades, intelligently refined to meet the needs of an expanding population. Immense storm drains, as strange as cosmic wormholes, burrowing through space-time to other universes, fed by countless smaller tributaries. Train and traffic tunnels running parallel or overhead, full of periodic rush and rumble. Elevated walkways in the drain walls that serve steel doors bearing cryptic symbols. Narrow side passages, leading to ladders ascending and ladders descending to he knows not what. Much of this elaborate subterranean architecture is old, like a setting in a Victorian novel, but somehow simultaneously futuristic, deeply mysterious in spite of its mundane purposes. By the beam of a tack light, Jimmy leads Nameless into this labyrinth of human ingenuity and industry. Such is the spectral nature of this place that, step by step, they seem to be making way toward not merely a confrontation with evil, but also toward some revelation that will change them forever.
"Many major drains, those that were upgraded over the past 60 years, terminate in big catch basins spanned by footbridges."
Freeman speaks quietly, echoes of his voice whispering along the curved gray walls.
"When the debris is settled out, the basins end in spillways that feed the water to the river. But there are a few, the older ones like this, that start from the heights and slope all the way to the lake. Here the catch basins are small and internal, and the runoff that gushes out of them still has muck in it."
As the big tunnel begins a gradual turn to the right, the floor slopes more severely. The flashlight is no longer the sole source of illumination. A faint glow creeps along the left-hand wall, as if a ghostly presence approaches, then appears across the entire arc of concrete. When they round the curve, the end of the drain reveals a large disk of dim, wintry daylight. Vertical bars, set 6 inches apart, prevent curious people from entering, while allowing runoff from the city to pass through. A hinged metal panel in the right-hand wall is set 6 feet above the floor.
"I broke the lock," Jimmy Freeman says. "They never fixed it."
He pulls the panel open, revealing a switch that operates the barrier ahead, which proves to be a portcullis that rises into the ceiling. Nameless and the boys step out onto a single beach, where a mantle woven by the storm softens the smooth stones. Behind them, the enormous mouth of the drain is set in a concrete retaining wall more than 20 feet high. The wind comes off the lake, forcing them to squint into the driven snow. 10 feet away, gray wavelets lick the stones clean. If there are ships on the water, they are hidden in the layered shrouds of streaming flakes.
The changing tides aren't as dramatic here as on the ocean, Jimmy Freeman explains. But some nights the beach is 3 or 4 feet underwater, and the lake reaches into the drain. That's when the yacht comes without running lights and stands like a mile offshore, always between 1 o'clock and 3 in the morning.
Nameless says, if it's a mile offshore and in the dark, how do you know it's a yacht?
On a cloudless night with a full moon, I've seen its profile, glassed it with binoculars. It's sleek like a pleasure craft. Big, but not a cargo ship, not industrial.
Seen it from where?
Once I knew they were operating under the city, I spied on them till I realized they were bringing merchandise in from the lake.
He gestures to the top of the retaining wall, high above the drain entrance.
Then I watch from behind that chain-link fence lying down. There's lots of factories up there, mostly old, many abandoned. No one's there to stop me coming and going. Anyway, the outlet's down like a 16-foot motor launch with 2 guys in it. They bring in the merchandise. Again, no running lights. The launch usually makes 2 trips. Sometimes 3. It drops anchor inside the flooded drain where they unload it.
Nameless says, the lake patrol never notices this suspicious behavior?
Someone tells them not to look. The city's full of people who go blind just when it's most important that they see.
10. As he follows the tracks in the snow, with Point Man looming close behind, Speedo believes that his big score may be at hand. The only thing he has ever believed in is that a big score will one day change his life. He doesn't believe education gets anyone anywhere. He doesn't believe in hard work. He doesn't believe in any human being, not even in himself. What shit happens to you, happens. And the only thing you can do is make the most of that one big score when you get the chance. He spends his life just hanging out, now and then cutting some loser's throat if he's told to do it, pistol-whipping some screw-up's mother if scarring her face will make the idiot mama's boy do what Dr. Zed wants. If too many weeks go by when he's not told to work someone over, boredom can set in. But then there's always a homeless guy or some ragged bitch living under a bridge to knock around. If he scores a big one, his life will change in ways Speedo can't even imagine. He only knows that it'll be someone way different and more important, living a more exciting life, with access to hotter women who crave him. And if his instinct is right, all this is going to happen for him because of that pussy Jimmy Freeman. Which is maybe ironic if Speedo knows what ironic means. A year earlier, on his own hook, while Jimmy was out and the mother was alone, Speedo went to their apartment to persuade the crippled bitch that a life in the gang was right for her pussy son. He meant to teach her some respect. Funny thing was, she had an unlicensed pistol, and made him beg her not to shoot him in the crotch. He thought of reporting her to the cops, and then going back when she didn't have the gun anymore. But if he did that, the story of how she embarrassed him might get out, and he didn't want to have to live that down. Now he and Point Man follow the 2 sets of tracks, moving faster as the howling wind erases the boot prints. They descend a block-long hill to a city property. A windowless brick building is surrounded by blacktop across which the wind ceaselessly shifts an inch of snow. Fixed to the chain-link fence is a faded sign. Lift Station 21. City property. No trespassing. As they walk across the broken-down gate, Pointman says,
what's a lift station?
Maybe where they keep machines they needed to lift things.
What things?
Heavy things.
The entrance is on the side of the building instead of the front, and the door is missing. The footprints go past the dark doorway, past a manhole from which someone brushed away a crust of snow. Cast in the iron cover is the word, sewer. The prints lead to, and end at, another manhole, 30 feet from the first. The cover has been set aside. The word on it is storm. Speedo and Point Man stand looking into the hole. The blizzard-filtered daylight reveals only the first 2 rungs of a ladder.
Where'd those losers go?
Point Man asks.
Down somewhere.
You're a major genius. We need us a flashlight.
Plus maybe a map of hell.
Ain't no hell.
Ain't heaven down there neither. You going into that dark?
After pulling his hood back and withdrawing some change from a pocket, Point Man kneels at the manhole and drops a quarter into it.
What are you doing, asswipe?
Listening to hear how deep is it.
This wind's screaming, you can't hear no coin plink.
Pointman drops a few smaller coins all at once and turns one ear to the darkness.
Must be real deep.
Exasperated, Speedo says,
Ain't no wishing well, Peckerbrain.
Getting to his feet, Pointman says,
So what are we gonna do?
All we can do is get out of this wind and wait. They didn't drag the manhole cover in place after themselves. They're gonna come back the way they went.
Maybe they didn't pull it because it's heavy. Maybe they ain't coming back like you think.
Yeah, and probably alligators already ate them down there.
Pulling up his hood, Pointman says,
That's what I'm thinking.
Speedo spits in the snow.
Ain't no alligators, man.
You just said,
It's a joke.
Gators ain't nothing to joke about.
Speedo heads toward the doorless entrance to the lift station. Pointman says,
You ever been down there?
Never flew to the moon, neither.
So you don't know if they're gators or not?
Not.
They take shelter in the darkness of the windowless brick building, watching the open manhole through the doorless doorway.
Back in the 50s,
Pointman says,
people come back from Florida with baby gators for souvenirs, no bigger than 2 inches. In a week, gator is 4 inches, 6 inches, people get scared, flush it down the toilet.
Oh, shit. Anyway, if true, there'd be alligators in the sewers, man, not the storm drains.
To start, yeah. But if you're a gator, you go where you want. Now you got gators everywhere down there.
Speedo chooses to respond with silence. Pointman sighs.
How long you think we're gonna have to wait?
However long, Speedo says. It'll feel like forever.
11. With the portcullis shut behind them, Nameless and his guide move up the sloped drain and inland from the lake, then into a smaller lateral tributary that requires them to proceed with their shoulders hunched and heads ducked. The small backpack that Nameless wears sometimes scrapes the ceiling. In a few hundred yards, they arrive at a drain the size of the one that led to the lake. Jimmy Freeman explains that this tunnel is newer, a half century old. It empties storm runoff into the river. Instead of ladder rungs embedded in the wall, here an open set of stairs leads up to the narrow service walk at the midpoint of the drain. They follow this wide ledge for 20 yards to a 4-square-foot stainless steel panel that appears to be snugly fitted with 9 bolts secured by hex nuts. After passing the tack light to Nameless and withdrawing a pair of lever wrench pliers from his jacket, Jimmy kneels and indicates the bolt at the bottom right corner of the panel.
Only this one matters. The others are for show.
As the kid turns the hex nut, from behind the panel come the sounds of gears turning, cams rotating, rods sliding.
It's not a bolt, Nameless says. It's a key to some complex lock mechanism. How did you know?
The deliveries that come in by boat are brought here on carts. Once I knew the routine, I hid over there and waited, watched.
He points across the tunnel to a 3-foot diameter pipe that opens about a foot below the ceiling.
I laid back where the shadows hid, but I still had a clear view with binoculars.
How far did you slither through that snake hole to get here?
I think about 300 feet of slope.
So you aren't claustrophobic?
I do feel that way sometimes above ground, but never down here. I'm free down here.
The gears turn a few more teeth, and the rods withdraw the last quarter inch of bolt from the striker plate. The 4x4 door swings inward. Jimmy crouches through the opening, and Nameless follows. The spacious room beyond allows them to stand. To the right are a pair of wide sliding doors serving a freight elevator. Directly ahead, a formidable steel door hangs ajar and a single barrel hinge as thick as a large bratwurst. They don't worry about being discovered, because their target is still doors and corridors anyway. The air has a faint chemical odor, as if it might be filtered for pathogens. According to the mission statement Nameless had listened to the previous evening, the elevator can be operated only by someone with a key. Consequently, Jimmy hasn't been able to access the cab or the service ladder in the shaft to discover from where it descends. As far as he knows, only 2 people ever used it, the man who lives down here, Spencer Wooten, and Michael McGinty. The kid shines the tack light on a plaque embedded in the wall by the elevator. This command and control bunker is a project of the National Preparedness Commission 1962, authorized by the President of the United States. The National Preparedness Commission had been a top-secret committee comprised of representatives of the CIA, the National Security Council, and each of the military services. How many of these facilities were built across the country during the Cold War can't be determined.
How did you eventually identify Wooten? Nameless wonders.
The men who deliver the guns every other month. Voices travel in the drains. Some call him Spencer, others call him Wooten.
And McGinty?
His face is always in the news. He's not the governor and he's not the mayor, but everybody knows he's the boss of bosses. He's got something on everyone, I guess. I saw him twice when he made his monthly visit. I overheard him and Wooten talking. I overheard a lot.
Jimmy had been in the bunker and explored its rooms 5 times. During many months of almost daily observation, listening for the sound of the freight elevator, he had learned Spencer Wooten's routine, learned when the man left his deep redoubt and how long he was gone. During 2 of those visits, Wooten returned unexpectedly, both times with McGinty. On each occasion, the boy slipped through the rooms and corridors, escaping undetected, while managing to eavesdrop on their conversations. Nameless knows all this from the recording that described his assignment, but his experience of this underworld has given him a greater appreciation of Jimmy Freeman's courage and ingenuity. Now Jimmy moves to the steel blast door.
There's 4 of these, all left ajar nowadays because they're so heavy, and because the closure mechanism doesn't work smooth like in the 1960s. Anyway, since this place is so secret, the doors are less about keeping people out than about defending against shockwaves and radioactive dust. McGinty won't come for almost an hour, that's his schedule, but Wooten will be in the bunker. From here on, we best go quiet.
After shrinking the width of the tack light beam and putting 2 fingers across the lens to soften the light, Jimmy opens the door and crosses the threshold into a concrete corridor about 6 feet wide and 7 feet high. Nameless follows. In sudden gloom, several rapid muzzle flashes flare bright with the sound of gunfire. In the violent dazzle, Jimmy Freeman staggers, falls, his collapse as silent as the weapon that felled him. He's face down, his yellow hooded head turned to the side, and in his profile, one eye is wide and sightless. The vision passes, leaving the kid on his feet and moving away from his companion along the corridor. Jimmy halts, glances back, perplexed. He motions for Nameless to follow. That moment of clairvoyance rocks Nameless, reanimates the very fear that assailed him when he first saw the boy. Worse, he senses there was some significant aspect of the vision that, in the shock of the gunfire, failed to register with him, a detail that might pinpoint the moment and place of the shooting. He can't will the vision to play again. He can only hope that the vital information, if it exists, is in his subconscious, and will eventually rise. He catches up with Jimmy and whispers, "I'll lead from here."
"But I'm the one who knows the way, and I have the tack light."
"So you'll show me, but stay a little behind, be alert."
The kid is quick, intuitive.
"What's wrong? What happened?"
"Nothing."
Nameless lies, but he draws his revolver.
"Instinct, protocol. I need a clear field of fire. Total quiet now."
In the damped beam of the tack light, they proceed. The corridor is L-shaped. After they turn to the right, another blast door lies before them. The light is steady in Freeman's hand. Spencer Wooten will be likely to fire at the kid first because the light he holds makes him the focus. There's nothing to be done about that. They dare not turn on the overhead lights. And even in tight quarters like these, Nameless requires a 2-handed grip on the chief's special to ensure that, in a sudden encounter, he can take out a hostile shooter before being killed. 12. In his study, Spencer Wooten sits at a quartzite-topped steel desk. He has draped the concrete walls with folds of scarlet velvet. He seems to be surrounded by a theater, as though he is an audience of one, waiting for a 360-degree play to begin. When he was a boy, between the ages of 12 and 16, he frequently had the same erotic dream that took place in a chamber with scarlet velvet walls, where he was attacked by slender naked girls of elfin beauty. They had fairy wings, and as one of them pleasured him, the other flew around his room in spasms of delight. Even back in the day, Spencer sensed that those fantastic dreams were about more than sex, that the girls were something more than girls. Those raptures of sleep were rich with symbols he could not interpret. Ever since the dreams stopped, he yearns for them to return with regularity. He believes there must be something he can do that will earn him those dreams for the rest of his life. He is haunted by them. Perhaps if he succeeds with the elementary school, he will be rewarded with a resumption of the dreams. By lamplight, he studies photos of the school that he's taken on one of his outings. Mickey McGinty has retrieved the architect's plans and the civil engineer's specifications to which the school was built. He also provided details of its current security system and emergency evacuation protocols. To protect against easy entrance by an armed gunman, all the exterior doors feature bulletproof glass and electronic locks that, if a gunman approaches, can be activated by any security guard or administrator with a cell phone. This makes it possible for the threat to be locked out. It also allows a clever hacker to lock the students in when they most desperately need to escape. The contractor had won a package bid to build an elementary school and two middle schools. He'd been generous to politicians and key bureaucrats. To recoup his contributions, he'd taken under-the-table kickbacks from subcontractors and suppliers, who in turn had made their wallets whole again by resorting to substandard materials and techniques. Three bricks of plastic explosives, detonated simultaneously, will cause a cascade of structural failures. The building is heated by natural gas. As the explosions rock the structure and collapse begins, broken gas lines will flood the crumbling school with fire. Fear is essential to force societal change. Citizens subjected to unrelenting terror are more likely to surrender their selfish freedoms in the interest of a better world for all. When the targets are innocent children, the powerful message sent to the hoi polloi is that no one is safe, that the perpetrators are so righteous in their cause that they recognize their struggle allows no room for sentiment or mercy. In the soft lamplight, the photos Spencer took of the school show children on a playground on a warm September day. The kids wear no coats. Some have a slender, elfin quality. Some are caught in mid-frolic, almost as if they have wings and are about to take flight. They remind him of the fairy lovers who long ago pleasured him in his sleep. He dares to think that as they perish in the destruction of the school, they will live again in his dreams, transformed into winged sylphs, his to enjoy, night after rapturous night. 13. Beyond the next blast door, the second L-shaped corridor takes a 90-degree turn to the left instead of the right, as did the previous one, and beyond the third blast door, a final L-shaped passage takes a turn to the right. The changes in direction are intended solely to foil radiation, which travels in a straight line. But the design seems excessive, considering that this redoubt must be at least 70 feet below the city, sealed under massive strata of concrete and bedrock. This structure is both serious and absurd, conceived by madmen incapable of recognizing the comic aspect of fleeing Armageddon by hiding in this snake pit for years with the expectation of one day ascending to rule the ruins above. If they didn't kill one another in their bunker, then when they did climb to the surface, not one of their kind would have known how to farm, attend to the husbandry of animals, mend shoe leather, fix an engine, produce antibiotics. Their only skill would have been politics, and whatever ragged survivors might still cling to life on the surface would have had enough of that forever. The fourth blast door moves with little noise on a well-oiled barrel hinge. The space beyond is revealed by the amber glow of two fat candles in clear glass bowls, their flames pulsing in a draft. Jimmy Freeman clicks off his tack light and follows Nameless into a receiving room. There are a desk, an office chair, and two straight-backed chairs circa 1962. Maybe new arrivals would have presented themselves here, seeking salvation in the hours before World War III, producing membership cards in the Club of Fools, engaging in a litany of passwords and countersigns. With intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of delivering their payloads perhaps 11 minutes after launch, Nameless wonders why those granted shelter imagined they would have enough warning to get here before they were vaporized. This descent has often been otherworldly, from the moment Nameless followed Jimmy into the manhole in the yard of the lift station. But this threshold marks an escalation from mere strangeness to an unnerving eeriness. The stark utilitarian furniture suggests that this is the first stop in a version of hell that will be a maze of demonic bureaucrats. The bright yellow walls meant to mock the hopelessness of all who enter here. The lambent candle flames a preview of more intense and eternal fires to come. Just enough candles have been lit. One here, two there, at most a cluster of three, to allow them to find the way through rooms and corridors that Jimmy estimates amount to 10 or 12,000 square feet. With gestures rather than words, the kid leads, though not from in front of Nameless, but staying to one side. The throbbing flames cast bright salamanders that skitter up the walls and also throw off shadows that writhe as though they are tormented spirits condemned to these catacombs. Nameless wonders from where a bullet might come to put a sudden end to young Jimmy's life. 14. Mickey McGinty has a chauffeur on staff when he wants one, but he always drives himself when paying a visit to the bunker. His Lincoln Aviator churns through the snow as smoothly as an aircraft through clouds. The bunker was top secret when it was built by the Army Corps of Engineers in 1962, a year before Mickey was born. No plans were filed with the building department. He was 28 when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War ended. 2 years later, he was president of the city council, the youngest in its history. The officials who had been approved to occupy the bunker in a nuclear war had signed non-disclosure agreements that included severe penalties if breached. None ever spoke of it. By the late 1990s, they were all either dead or taking a drunkard's walk on the brink of dementia. Mickey had heard rumors of the bunker. He expended much time and effort to confirm its existence. Recognizing that the facility might have its uses if kept strictly secret, he took every action he could to ensure that the truth of it was quashed and its location remained unknown. Having transferred the facility to the city at Mickey's insistence, the federal government consigned the project to the memory hole where the bureaucracy routinely shovels all evidence of the waste of money. A windowless building houses the shaft head of the elevator that serves the bunker. It stands on a lot surrounded by a chain-link fence topped by razor wire. Signs declare that hazardous medical waste is processed here. They warn of the grave risk of the toxic materials. The walls are 3 foot thick steel-reinforced concrete, and the roll-aside steel doors are operated by a powerful prison gate motor that responds to Mickey's remote control. These monumental garage doors provide the sole entrance. Mickey drives inside. He waits in the SUV until the big doors roll shut. Then he gets out from behind the wheel. Overhead lights have come on automatically, revealing one large room, about 100 feet long and 40 wide, with a 20-foot ceiling. When he closes the driver's door, the sound echoes through this hollow space like the thud of a coffin lid. Twice a month, Mickey's middle son Liam leaves a vehicle here, and Spencer Wooten packs it full of weapons that have been ordered by unlicensed distributors. Because Liam owns a company that leases specialty vehicles to government and private sector entities, these deliveries are therefore made in ambulances, armored trucks, mobile library vans, and the like. The freight elevator, which can be operated only with a key, rumbles up from the depths when Mickey commands it. His oldest son, Patrick, owns a company that installs and services elevators in a few hundred high-rise buildings, and it is only Patrick and his son, Phelan, who personally keep this ancient model working, without requiring a contract or keeping service records. Mickey McGinty believes in the American dream as he understands it, and he knows that American prosperity is dependent on tens of thousands of small businesses, sometimes openly, often via shell corporations. The McGinty family, including his other children, Connor and Angelica, is doing its part to help the economy flourish. Their many businesses might not be as small as a family-run pharmacy or a neighborhood bar. However, they're inarguably small compared to Apple or Microsoft. Mickey is proud that he, a little guy from the neighborhood, earned his piece of the dream. The country will be a far better place when those thousands of small businesses owned by less competent entrepreneurs are consolidated into the hands of a few hundred visionaries like himself, come the revolution. Though he's of two minds about how soon a revolution is desirable. The elevator arrives. Mickey steps aboard, employs his key again, and descends. 15. Spencer Wooten uses a magnifying glass to study the children in the photographs of the school playground. He wonders if touching them would repulse him as does touching a grown woman. He's pretty sure the answer is yes. Although these frolicking children are a bit like the erotic winged nymphs in his adolescent dreams, they are still human beings, and humanity is the thing that disgusts him, as cockroaches disgust others. The only person he can touch intimately without abhorrence is himself. According to Education Department records, 384 students are enrolled at the school. A number of deaths sufficient to strike terror in the hearts of all parents in the city, perhaps in the nation. This prospect so enchants Spencer, his attention is so intently fixed on the children in the photo, that he is not aware of the two men until they are in front of his desk. One of them has a gun. As usual, Spencer wears his shirt untucked, and a revolver is snugged in a holster on his right hip under the shirt. Furthermore, there's a pistol in the top right-hand desk drawer. He has not armed himself with the expectation that dangerous intruders will ever find this place, but rather in anticipation of a day when Mickey McGinty might have no further use for him. Putting down the magnifying glass so that it rattles against the desktop, Spencer avoids acting like a man who has firearms within reach. He crosses both hands defensively on his chest. His self-pity, born from a life as an outsider, makes it possible for him to summon tears on demand.
"Don't hurt me. Oh, God, please don't. I'll do anything you want."
16. Having disembarked from the freight elevator, Mickey McGinty follows the L-shaped corridors, through blast doors left ajar, and comes to the bunker. There are overhead lights, and no reason not to use them. The power is hijacked from the electric company. No one is billed for it. Yet Wooten insists on candlelight, which annoys Mickey, because it seems so affected, theatrical, melodramatic, and feminine. Mickey has never had the fullest confidence in Spencer. Pale, with no apparent beard, and with faded blue eyes, the man has an otherworldly quality. He's childlike, with a mysterious smile and fey manner. Of course, even though well-paid, any Jacobin revolutionary with 3 college degrees who is willing, indeed eager, to live alone in this windowless hole, planning terrorist attacks that he lacks the nerve to execute, is likely to have less than a sparkling personality. Nevertheless, Mickey lately has suspected that a day is coming when Spencer will do something that requires his consignment to the power pack cremation system. Finding a replacement for him will be a delicate task, but in this city there will be a satisfactory pool of like-minded, highly educated candidates from which to choose. He makes his way through candlelit chambers, toward the velvet-lined study. Because the comparison grates on Spencer, Mickey calls out, "So where the hell is my Phantom of the Opera?" 17. From long and patient observation, Jimmy Freeman knows that McGinty always arrives at the same time, never early or late by more than 5 minutes. But today, he is half an hour ahead of schedule. The plan was to incapacitate Spencer Wooten, secure him hand and foot, and then lie in wait for the city councilman. Not anymore. When McGinty delivers his Phantom of the Opera joke, he sounds close, so that the man who isn't Ricardo de Verdad pivots toward the open door, whereupon Wooten rolls his chair back from the desk and starts to get to his feet as he pulls open a drawer. For 6 years, Jimmy has been a ghost under the city, haunting the maze of passageways, leaving no more evidence of his presence than a spirit might. In the 20 months since he discovered the arms-dealing operation, he has crept into this place to explore, never leaving any trace of an intrusion. Now he goes from benign ghost to enraged poltergeist, springing onto the desk and launching himself at Wooten. The gun that was in the drawer is now in Wooten's hand. Jimmy collides with the creep, and Wooten staggers back into the office chair with the weapon between them. The shot is the loudest sound Jimmy has ever heard. 18. When McGinty appears in the doorway, his eyes go wide at the sight of the muzzle of the .357 Chief Special, which is aimed at the bridge of his nose from a distance of less than 4 feet. Before the councilman can raise his hands, something crashes behind Nameless. A gunshot roars, and another crash follows. He turns his head and sees no one, because Freeman and Wooten are evidently on the floor beyond the desk. When McGinty fumbles under his topcoat for whatever piece he might be carrying, Nameless at once turns back to him, drives a knee into his crotch, slams a forearm up and under his chin, clubs him alongside the head with the gun, and steps back so the councilman won't fall on his boots. McGinty folds into unconsciousness with the grace of a stack of bricks. As Wooten's gun roars again, shudders of dread wash through Nameless, for he's sure that the vision he saw has been fulfilled, that Jimmy is dead, that he's failed the boy. He rounds the desk, where he finds Wooten flat on his back. The kid has one knee on the man's chest and is in possession of the pistol.
"Who's hit?" Nameless asks.
"The desk," Jimmy says. "He wounded it twice."
"You know how to use a gun?"
Nameless asks. "Point it and squeeze the trigger."
"Not a master marksman's technique, but good enough for the moment.
Keep him down and quiet while I deal with McGinty." 19. The armory is brightened by more candles than any other room, perhaps 36, as if this is not a shrine celebrating the memory of those whose lives will be taken by these weapons, but instead a sacrarium honoring those who will pull the triggers. Surveying row after row of metal shelves, Nameless estimates there are 5,000 or 6,000 guns here. Millions of dollars of inventory. According to Jimmy, it turns over 3 times a year. The kid has been intense, wound tight with righteous anger, but now a heretofore repressed bitterness sharpens his face and informs his voice.
"The bribes, kickbacks, city contracts given to friends of the family, donations to the phony McGinty Foundation, all of that is never enough. He has to make a buck selling black market weapons so gangbangers and other zombies can prove how tough they are by killing little kids and old ladies, and people just trying to make an honest living."
"People like your dad," Nameless says, putting a hand on the kid's shoulder.
"Like my dad."
"With McGinty, especially with Wooten, it isn't just about making money. In fact, it isn't much about that at all. Wooten has gone silent the past few years, but he was all over the internet for a long time with his rants and manifestos."
The kid says, "Yeah, I researched him. I read his crap. Who has he ever been? What has he ever done? Has he ever held a real job? Been a barber so good that he was booked up every day? All the fool has ever been is a dreamer dreaming sick dreams, a hater who hates everything but power and death."
Under his hand, Nameless feels tremors coursing through Jimmy Freeman, an electrifying current of emotion.
"You're quite something. Your father would be proud of you. Now it's time for you to go."
"No, I'm here for all of it."
Nameless removes his hand from the kid's shoulder.
"From what I've been told, that isn't the deal."
The kid looks like a beatified martyr in the glow of the many candles. "If you call in the cops, even with all this evidence, some judge will let him go. People like him always get away with it."
"I'm not calling in the police. The system has failed to deal with McGinty for more than 3 decades, and Wooten is the kind who will too easily be turned into the next counterculture hero, his face on t-shirts and posters."
Jimmy surveys the weapons, as if every one was the gun that killed his father. He meets his companion's eyes once more.
"So what are you going to do to them? How do you get any kind of justice?"
"There's little justice in this world of lies, Jimmy. I'm not interested in justice. I'm interested in truth. They're different things. I make people like McGinty and Wooten face the truth and the consequences of it."
"Which is what?"
"You don't need to know the details."
"But I do."
"That makes you an accomplice.
It makes me responsible. There's a difference."
Nameless considers what has been said, and he who said it. If Jimmy had been a boy when this began, he wasn't one any longer.
You can't force me to go, he says. I need to know what happens, that this is done, that they pay for everyone who's died because of them. They don't arm honest citizens. They arm the thugs, knowing what will happen. I want to be here for whatever.
The vision of this young man felled by a gunshot seems to have gone unfulfilled. The danger passing when McGinty and Wooten were restrained. Sometimes these premonitions are not about what will happen, but about what might happen if Nameless is not cautious. He relents. We'll finish it together. But it's human sometimes to have some sympathy for the devil. Maybe years from now you might suffer remorse.
Not for these devils, Jimmy assures him.
In the room with velvet-lined walls, in the light of the desk lamp and the glow of candles standing on the other furniture, each of the devils lies on the floor, bound with zip ties at wrists and ankles. Hair hanging in damp clumps across his sweat-slicked face, Wooten has exhausted himself in the fruitless struggle to break free. Having just regained consciousness, McGinty seems to think that he can dissolve his bonds in a torrent of acidic obscenities. Nameless invites them to contemplate the muzzle of the Smith & Wesson. Mere seconds of meditation on that dark hole inspires the two men to be attentive. Nameless describes the fate that they have earned. The condemned men are so certain that they are beyond hope, so numbed by contemplation of the horror awaiting them, that they can think of nothing to say, although until now they've been able to have their way in the world by shaping words into lies. 20. As Jimmy pulls the steel door of the bunker shut, Nameless shrugs out of his backpack and kneels on the floor to extract what he needs from the tools and materials he has brought.
I've been wondering, he says, how you found the people I work with.
I didn't. I told my Uncle Forrest what I'd learned, what I'd found down here, and he knew what to do. He's my mom's brother. He's the best.
But how did he know about us? We for sure don't advertise.
Uncle Forrest is a cop, one of the good ones. There are some, maybe most of them. But he says, in this city, even the police can't move against McGinty or anyone in that crowd. The district attorney is one of them, too, him and everyone in his office. So who's going to bring the charges to a court? The governor and attorney general are as corrupt as McGinty, and he put them where they are today.
So your uncle knew about us how?
Feelers.
As he puts on a tinted face shield, Nameless says,
Feelers?
Uncle Forrest said there's some people have feelers out to cops like him. Cops they trust for whatever reason. He doesn't know who they are, but they come highly recommended by people he trusts. They want to know all about cases that never got prosecuted but should, about criminals who are guilty as hell, open and shut cases that no one will touch because of who the perps are, because they're rich or high up in politics. We've got two justice systems these days, one for them and their kind, and another system for all the rest of us.
Nameless never thinks much about who puts together his missions and gives him what he needs to fulfill them. No doubt his lack of curiosity is programmed, along with his amnesia. Although he knows very little about the organization that he serves, its resources are impressive. If they have feelers out to cops, they have them out to all kinds of potential informants in the public and private sectors. After pulling on a pair of thick gloves, he says,
Better step back about 10 or 15 feet.
Isn't there something I can do to help?
Son, you've already done more than I have. I'll be finished here in a few minutes.
21. Mickey McGinty believes the only love that's real is love of self, that those who claim to love others are either the worst kind of frauds or fools who don't understand themselves. Human beings are predators. Predators have no time for sentiment if they want to avoid being devoured by other predators. He has a wife, Samantha, whom he doesn't love, and he's had many lovers whom he despised, simply because he needed the pleasure they provided. Back in the day, a politician had to have a wife to be considered respectable. Samantha's the perfect spouse, because she has the right look, comes from a classy background, and is a ruthless bitch. Never has Mickey loved himself more desperately than he does now, after that son of a bitch sentenced him to a slow and gruesome death. He is infatuated with himself, determined not to accept the fate that has been thrust upon him. He's got a headache from being knocked upside the head with a revolver, a tender throat, and a bruised jaw. but the minute those who have imprisoned him leave the room, he hitches across the floor and sits with his back against the red velvet wall. He draws his knees toward his chest, and even with shackled hands, manages to pull up the right leg of his pants to reveal the sheath attached to his calf with Velcro. He frees the switchblade in the sheath, clicks it open, points it toward himself, and saws at the plastic zip tie. Spencer Wooten is useless. He lies on the floor, as flaccid as a spineless jellyfish, sobbing as if he's a child. He has given up. Wooten is no more a revolutionary than Mickey is a men's club pole dancer. The sight of him sickens Mickey. With his hands suddenly free, he sets to work frantically cutting the zip tie linking his ankles, and it parts in less than a minute. He scrambles to his feet. His pistol, but not Wooten's, has been left on the desk. He retrieves his weapon. As the stench of roses burns in his nose, he hurries through the bunker's maze of chambers, creating a draft that makes the candle flames swell and sway. Huge wing shapes of light and shadow fluttering up the walls, as if this must be the laboratory of a mad scientist breeding monstrous moths. In the receiving room, he goes to the blast door and tries to open it, without success. This slab of steel is tightly fitted to the frame, but he can hear the faint hiss of the acetylene torch as his jailers work on the far side. The door isn't merely locked. As the man who clubbed him has promised, they are welding it shut. 22. Without pleasure, taking no moral satisfaction in this task, but reminding himself of the many children who have been either collateral damage in gang wars or the chosen targets of psychopathic thugs, Nameless welds the door to the frame at three points. If truth matters at all, then you must act when you learn the undeniable truth of a great evil that has been committed. Inaction in the face of such hard knowledge is at best cowardice. At worst, it's a rejection of the values of truth, an admission that you prefer a life of lies in spite of the horrors that metastasize from the compounding deceits. He is not a vigilante. Vigilantes act on emotion rather than reason, on mere suspicion instead of truth. They take action even when the law is just and the courts beyond reproach. If the law had not for decades been often retooled from an instrument of justice into one of political control, if district attorneys and attorney generals and prosecutors hadn't frequently chosen to protect rather than prosecute the criminal elites in their social circle, there would be no Ace of Diamonds, no organization intent on bringing the truth and its consequences to people like McGinty, and Nameless would not be here. With the blast door now a fixed barrier that might stand for centuries, Nameless follows Jimmy Freeman through the L-shaped corridors to the freight elevator in the vestibule. The large cab is at this level, where McGinty left it on his arrival. In 10 minutes, when Nameless finishes with the lift mechanism, it won't function any longer. If eventually some curious soul descends the 7-story shaft on the service ladder and enters the cab from its ceiling, he will find the sliding doors welded shut. 23. The wretched specimen who is Spencer Wooten is unable to stay on his feet. Although his wrists are still bound together, the zip tie linking his ankles has been cut, yet he staggers as though he remains shackled. Such is his self-pity and dread that he is unable to stop weeping. Each time he falls to his knees, he must be prodded to his feet. Nonetheless, he obeys Mickey McGinty and haltingly makes his way through the bunker to its ultimate chamber. Mickey has long been aware that most revolutionaries, though claiming they want to tear down the system to be free, are in fact eager to kneel before the cruelest masters of their ideology. They are destroyers rather than creators. On some profound level they realize this and yearn to be told what role they must play in the new world of their dreams. When they are finished tearing down a civilization, they enslave themselves to Hitler, to Stalin, to any tyrant ascending, and thereafter take a drone's pleasure in being a faithful servant of the hive, freedom forgotten. The prospect of being imprisoned with the odious Wooten for even one day, let alone a week or longer, is more than Mickey can bear. In the cremation chamber, after the lights are switched on, Wooten does as he's told, clambering onto the cadaver table without protest
and evidently without any sense of what Mickey intends. It would be gratifying to strap the man down and fire up the cremator and feed him to it alive. But he isn't likely to remain clueless long enough for that scenario to play out. Instead, Mickey holsters his pistol and uses his knife to slash Wooten's throat twice. First the right carotid, and then the left. Shocked to the reality of his situation, Wooten clasps his throat. However, when blood is lost this fast and at such volume, death quickens from the brain through the body. Mickey wipes his knife on Wooten's pants and pockets it. He fires up the furnace. He submits Wooten's corpse to the flames and closes the door. He turns out the room lights. He makes his way through candlelight and the insistent scent of roses to the large kitchen, where he selects a bottle of fine Cabernet from the wine cooler. He intends to pass the time as pleasurably as possible until he is rescued. Although this place is unknown to the rest of the world, his sons are aware of it, and they will come for him soon. Then he'll find out who those two are who have dared to act against him. They will wish they were never born, and will beg for a death as quick as Wooten's. 24. With the elevator disabled beyond easy repair and the sliding doors welded shut, Nameless follows Jimmy out of the vestibule and through the 4-foot square panel that serves as the entrance to the bunker complex. Once they're on the narrow service walk at the midpoint of the enormous drain, Nameless holds the tack light while Jimmy closes the panel and uses his lever wrench pliers on the bolt at the bottom right corner, which engages the secret lock mechanism. The kid works quickly, efficiently, and then takes the tack light to lead the way down the open stairs to the drain floor. He says nothing, all the way back to the lift station in the condemned neighborhood where they first came underground. He has waited 11 years for someone to pay a price for the murder of his father, and he has taken great risks after discovering the source of the illegal and untraceable weapons plaguing the city and state. He has the right stuff, no doubt about it. However, a love of truth and a courageous heart inevitably come with a conscience. It's a package deal. His silence is the brooding kind, and he's surely tormenting himself with questions about the righteousness of what they have done. Jimmy knows that pure evil exists in this world and must be resisted, but he is too young to understand how implacable evil is, how uncompromising. He is yet to grasp that anyone standing against evil may allow himself a measure of pity for those who give themselves to wickedness, but never have sympathy for them. It is the nature of an injured snake to bite and poison whoever attempts to nurse it back to health. As they pass from the large drain into one little more than half that diameter, with their heads only inches from the curve of concrete above them, Nameless is considering whether and how to discuss the issue of evil with Jimmy. The kid halts 10 feet from the opening to the vertical drain by which they entered more than 2 hours earlier. To make their exit easier on return, they hadn't dragged the heavy iron manhole cover into place. In the pale light falling through that aperture, snowflakes shudder down, cast out by the day by shrieking wind. Jimmy turns sideways so that Nameless can see past him. The beam of the tack light is focused on a scattering of bright coins on the dark concrete floor. If they had been dropped through the open manhole, they rolled or bounced several feet before coming to rest. In these circumstances, 53 cents of pocket change seems as mysterious as a strange totem unearthed on an archaeological dig. The gleaming coins had not been here before. If they had spilled from the pocket of someone who had descended in search of Nameless and Jimmy, an attack would surely have occurred already. How this small offering has come to be here is less important than the fact that it suggests someone potentially hostile might lurk in the day above. They retreat from the coins, and Jimmy says, "There are other ways out in this general area, though none as convenient as this."
"Just tell me we don't have to transfer from the storm drains to the sewer."
Jimmy grins.
"It doesn't work that way."
"Good. These are new boots."
25. In the best of weather, Speedo isn't an outdoorsman. And on a day like this, he would rather be in a pool hall or a bar with poker action in the back room. But here he is inside the lift station with Point Man, freezing his ass off, and not sure why anymore,
It seemed like a good idea 2 hours ago, lying low to mess with Freeman and his pal when they came back, except that maybe they aren't ever coming back the same way they went. Speedo is wearing a quilted jacket with a hood, but whatever shit it's lined with isn't enough protection against cold like this that could freeze your nipples off. "Enough of this shit," he says. "Let's get out of this place."
"But this here's our big chance to get tight with Dr. Zed."
"Maybe it was then, but there's no chance now. Anyway, Zed can kiss my ass. He ain't no doctor, anyway."
"Everybody knows he ain't. It's just what he calls himself. Like you call yourself Speedo."
"Maybe I'll start calling myself Pope Speedo. You can stand here till you piss ice cubes, but I'm splitting."
"Man, that can't really happen, can it?"
"What can't?"
"The ice cube thing? I passed the kidney stone. Thought I'd die."
"Maybe you should have and made your mama happy," Speedo says, heading for the street, squinting through driving snow so thick it half blinds him. The vertical drain is perhaps 3 feet wide, but it is so old that it's not made of formed concrete. Considering the many decades that hard-fired bricks have been in service, they've held up well. Jimmy climbs the 10 feet to the top and forces the drainage grill to one side and levers himself out. When Nameless follows, he finds they're in an alleyway, where abandoned residential properties back up on either side. Since they've been underground, the temperature has dropped into Arctic territory, and the wind is amped up. Conditions are nearing whiteout, and the storm seems to be erasing the city.
"Which way to the house where you're camped out?" Jimmy asks,
raising his voice to compete with the storm. Eidetic memory, the ability to recall vividly, with a reliable accuracy and exquisite detail, anything that Nameless has seen is of less use to him here, where infinite veils of driven snow blur or entirely mask all landmarks. He says,
"This way, I think,"
and moves with the wind instead of against it. Speedo follows Point Man along the chain-link fence between the condemned neighborhood and the street on which they parked when they first saw that pussy Jimmy Freeman in his stupid yellow winter hoodie. They're looking for their Escalade, so their attention isn't focused on the houses to their left. Speedo isn't thinking about the only thing that he believes in, which is that one day he'll have a score so big it'll change his life. Nevertheless, at just the right moment, he glances to his left between two houses, and damn if he doesn't glimpse Freeman's yellow gear. Even through the sheeting snow and in the dim stormlight and at a distance, he sees Freeman and the big dude who was with him earlier. Slapping the back of Point Man's hooded head hard enough that the fool will feel it, Speedo shouts, "It's them! It's them!" Nameless leads Jimmy between two houses, from the alleyway to a tree-lined street, where the leafless configurations of the bare limbs match patterns in his memory. A birdbath in a shallow front yard, a porch with several missing balusters in its railing, a low iron stave fence with a broken gate hanging from one hinge. The blizzard is insufficient to mask these landmarks. Nameless says,
"Four doors down on the right."
In a living neighborhood, even in intense cold and unforgiving wind, ecstatic children would be celebrating the magic of snow, the benign paralysis of daily routine, and the prospect of school cancellations. The previous day, these streets were desolate, but now they're lonelier and grimmer, the architecture of despair. As they leave the public sidewalk and approach the safe house, he recalls the augural image of Jimmy being shot, of the kid lying face down, his yellow hooded head turned to the side, one sightless eye open wide. Now Nameless registers the significant detail of the vision that had escaped his attention in the shock of that foreseen barrage of gunfire. Jimmy had fallen onto ground that was mantled with snow. The threat to the kid won't come from a Ginty or Wooten, but from a source unknown and unpredictable. Nameless halts at the foot of the porch steps, turns, sweeps the day with his gaze. Perhaps 30 yards away, screened by the storm, two blurred figures in the street seem to drift toward them like revenants returning from hell to do the devil's work. The front door isn't locked. There's no point to locks in a neighborhood waiting for bulldozers and wrecking balls. Nameless pushes Jimmy ahead of him, up the steps, onto the porch.
"Go get inside. Stay away from windows. Get to the second floor, now."
Alone on the porch, standing at the open door, Nameless strips off his gloves and drops them. He
He draws the revolver from his hip holster and holds it down at his side, wondering if in this fierce wind it will be of any use except at point-blank range. Maybe these two guys are nothing to worry about. Maybe they're just urban explorers attracted to the strangeness of an abandoned neighborhood. Maybe they were raised here as children and have come back on a sentimental journey. Maybe they're Santa Claus's helpers, just checking to be sure no kids are left here to take delivery from St. Nick at the end of next month. Staying off the sidewalk, staying near the gutter in the street to use the meager cover of the winter-stripped trees, not running in these treacherous conditions but moving fast, Speedo and Point Man are closing on Freeman and his companion when the big guy suddenly turns and spots them. The kid ducks inside, but the stranger stands by the open front door, watching them approach. Anywhere in this city of strict gun laws, from the high-rise penthouses to condemned neighborhoods, it's likely that a third of the people are carrying concealed weapons. Speedo and Point Man carry their illegal Glock 18 full-auto pistols in their left hands, using their bodies to hide the guns. It's to be expected that the guy in the porch has at least a 5-round Tre 8 or something bigger. Nuns are about the only citizens you can be sure aren't packing heat, and Speedo doesn't even trust them. Point Man knows this as well as Speedo knows it, and he knows that just because a guy shows you his piece, either on purpose or mistakenly, that's no reason to jump the moment and turn a quiet standoff into 4th of July fireworks. What Point Man knows doesn't always inform what Point Man does. The two in the street appear not to be interested in Nameless, seem to be focused on slogging straight ahead through the storm. However, while their right arms move in harmony with their bodies, their left arms hang straight down at their sides, as though they're both afflicted by a lingering paralysis following strokes, or are trying to conceal guns that can be brought into a two-handed grip in an instant. If they're nothing but a pair of low-life muggers out to score wallets and watches, they'll move on if he lets them see his Smith & Wesson, which is what he does as he backs into the open doorway. In spite of Point Man's limitations, the thing that makes Speedo want to continue hanging out with them is that, like the man himself said earlier, when he wants to be, he's meaner than anyone. Speedo has seen his partner perpetrate vicious violence on both people who crossed him and people who were strangers to him. He will cripple and disfigure for the sheer pleasure of it. He once blinded a young girl because he didn't like the way she looked at him. Speedo can do quick knife work or pop a cap, though he doesn't have quite what it takes for meaner stuff like torture. But he's highly entertained by the verve and imagination that Point Man brings to such tasks. The downside to this friendship is that Point Man sometimes gets them into hairy situations, because he goes off half-cocked. He's much better than he used to be in that regard, which Speedo attributes to the stabilizing influence that he has had on the man. Said influence proves to be inadequate when the stranger on the porch shows his piece. This is done not in a threatening way. The guy just wants them to know what he has, and thereby encourage them to move on. But for whatever reason, Point Man takes the gesture as an intolerable affront to his honor. He veers off the street, steps between two trees and onto the sidewalk, brings his Glock 18 to bear, and opens fire. In this howling wind, at this distance from the target, even with an automatic weapon that lets off 8- and 10-round bursts, a hit isn't guaranteed, especially considering that Point Man is no one's idea of a marksman. Glass shatters and wood splinters, and the guy in the porch either falls or throws himself sideways through the doorway, rolling into the darkness of the house. By the time he's through the low gate and onto the front walk, Point Man has emptied the Glock. He pauses to eject the depleted magazine and snap in a fresh one. Then he squeezes off what sounds like a 6-round burst to make the guy inside keep his head down. In this storm, the rattle of gunfire won't carry beyond these condemned streets. No patrol car will cruise by, and no neighbors exist to call 911. Perhaps this unique privacy in the heart of the city thrills Point Man and inspires this showdown and dodge shootout. Speedo follows Point Man because, well, he too likes those old westerns, although the sheriff never takes a bullet in the gut like you hope he will. Besides, they're a team, and maybe this somehow is going to lead to his big score, after all. Even if the only good to come of it is that they kill that pussy of pussies, Jimmy Freeman, it's going to be interesting. Something to tell a whore about in bed, after the main event,
When he still has time, he's paid for, and he can't think of anything to say. If life isn't interesting, then what's the point of living? Nameless is not pleased to be standing with his back to the front wall, between the open door and the shattered window. This house surely served well the families who lived in it over the decades, but it had not been constructed to withstand barrages of high-velocity rounds with full metal jackets. Those bullets that hit a stud are stopped, but those that pass between studs are able to pierce the thin, dry clapboard, shred through the insulation, and pierce the interior drywall while still having enough punch to crack through his skull if his head happens to be in the way. He is where he is, however, because he intends to step to the doorway between bursts of automatic weapons fire, where they will never expect him to appear. They will come quickly and recklessly, because they'll think he and Jimmy are retreating out the back door. If he surprises them by being reckless himself, maybe he can take them down as they come onto the porch. In the lull of automatic fire, as he pivots toward the doorway, he hears a different weapon, a semi-automatic. Pop, pop, pop. Point Man climbs the porch steps, staying low, ready to empty his second magazine on anyone who dares the doorway. Speedo is behind his partner, not yet on the steps, his keen attention and the muzzle of his Glock on the shattered window to the left of the door in case someone tries to take a shot from there. Because the snow is in harried motion and the violent wind shakes everything, because he imagines Freeman's companion to be as much a pussy as Jimmy and therefore in full flight, Speedo fails to see his fate approaching on his left from around the corner of the house. The first shot alerts him when it punches him in the shoulder and staggers him almost off his feet. Although pain dims his vision, as he turns toward the threat, he clearly sees Jimmy no more than 10 feet away, the hood of the kid's jacket thrown back, snow frosting his hair, a pistol in both hands. His face is not wrenched by either hatred or anger. Something else informs his expression, something that Speedo can't name but that terrifies him, as he has never been terrified before. The second shot misses him, but his only weapon is abruptly too heavy to lift. He doesn't see the muzzle flash of the third shot. Nameless steps into the doorway as the farther of the two men crumples in a spray of blood droplets that speckle the snow like holly berries. The nearer man, distracted by the shots that have taken down his partner, squeezes off a burst of fire in the general direction of Jimmy Freeman. As he registers the danger from which he's been diverted, he turns his head, one eye rolling, more white than iris, like that of a horse in panic. From a distance of 6 feet, Nameless puts all 5 rounds from his .357 in the bastard, doing vastly more damage to him than is necessary. But there's no reason to conserve ammunition. By habit, he breaks out the cylinder and quickly feeds the Smith & Wesson 5 rounds with a speed loader, although no one is left to shoot. His ears are ringing from the gunfire, so that he can't for the moment hear the skirling wind. Jimmy comes around to the steps. He climbs onto the porch. As the sound of the wind gradually returns, Nameless indicates the pistol in the boy's hand.
Wooten's gun.
Yeah.
I didn't know you'd taken it.
Thought you wouldn't want me to.
Good thing you did. You all right?
Right enough, I guess.
I regret you had to do this.
Someone had to. They've been wanting it a long time.
You know them?
Gangbangers. They've been after me to join since I was 12, and when eventually I wouldn't, then they were just after me. Can't imagine how they found me today.
Synchronicity. Things happen as they need to happen. Give me the pistol, I'll dispose of it.
They didn't give us a better option, did they?
Nameless says, just remember that, and you'll be okay.
26.
There's no reason to wipe down the surfaces in the safe house. Jimmy touches nothing there. Nameless cannot incriminate himself that way. Before these missions began, his fingerprints were removed by multiple applications of light acids and lasers. With his gear loaded in the back of the Explorer, he and Jimmy leave the desolate neighborhood. Even beyond that 3-square-block graveyard of stolen dreams, the streets have not yet been addressed by plows or salt spreaders, but the all-wheel drive SUV navigates them with grace. At the stoplight, Jimmy displays a photograph of his mother and father that he keeps on his phone.
She's lovely, and your dad was a handsome man, Nameless says, for that is true. He looked just like him.
He was killed on a day like this, the snow so bad he shouldn't have bothered going to work.
No more than 3 or 4 people would have shown up for a haircut. But he took pride in his shop and his work. He said hard work kept a man honest, and any dollar you didn't earn might be the one you needed most someday. They ride in thoughtful silence until Nameless asks, "Did your dad wear a yellow jacket like the one you have on?" "Yeah, yellow was his favorite color. The barber pole outside his shop was a custom job. Not red and white, but yellow and white. The chairs in his shop were upholstered in yellow. He said canaries sang such happy songs because they were yellow." The clairvoyant vision had not been a warning of a murder to come, but a glimpse of a murder that occurred 11 years in the past. Yet it had stopped his nerves and given him an edge that might have made all the difference to the outcome of the day. When Nameless parks in front of the building where Jimmy lives in an apartment with his mother, he says, "Does your mom know about the house in a safe and quiet town? The money to start a business?" "No. I didn't want her to know anything until all this was done with. She would have been worried sick." "She'll have 1,000 questions. Mom's brother will come over, and together we'll explain everything to her." "Michael Forrest, the cop. Maybe you and Forrest should edit the story a little." Jimmy frowns. "I won't lie. I'll tell her everything. She's in a wheelchair, but she's as tough as anyone I know."
"You'll be her hero."
He shrugs. "Well, she's already mine."
"You know what town yet?"
"No, they'll tell us tomorrow, I think. We'll be gone from here in a week, maybe sooner." Nameless offers his hand. They shake and hold fast to each other for a moment.
"I'll come visit you someday, Jim. Or would you prefer James?"
"Jim is good. I'll look forward to that visit. I really will."
Jim Freeman gets out of the Explorer and closes the door and walks away through the falling snow. At the door to the apartment house, he stops on the stoop and looks back and waves, and then he disappears inside. Piloting the Explorer out of this once shining city, Nameless feels as if he's escaping some disaster that looms like a tsunami over the great towers of the metropolis. The feeling depresses him and frightens him, but for all the music on the radio, nothing can help him shake his dread. 27. As twilight settles on the world above, Mickey McGinty sits in candlelight, having moved an armchair and a small table here to the cremation room. He dines on a selection of cheeses and sliced beef from Spencer Wooten's larder. He's partaking of a second bottle of superb Cabernet, for the first one has had no effect on him. He will not necessarily have been missed yet. Maybe not until midnight. When he doesn't come home, Samantha will suppose that he is with one of his women. He never stays the night with any of those bitches. Always makes it home to his wife by the witching hour. His wife and their sons know where he goes the second Wednesday of every month. In the morning, they will come to the building at the bunker service shaft, find his Lincoln Aviator, and discover that the elevator is disabled. They will devise a way to free him, whether that entails repair of the elevator or a rescue party that comes in from the lake and through the storm drains. Although he has no doubt that he will be out of this prison in a day or two, there is something about which he's concerned. Spencer Wooten worries him. He doesn't know why this should be the case. Wooten had been consigned to the white-hot fire in the furnace and rendered into ashes hours earlier. Even if for whatever reason the flames did not consume the corpse, it nonetheless is a lifeless body with slashed carotids, locked in the power pack as though in a coffin. A most practical man, a man of reason, Mickey entertains none of the silly superstitions that hobble other men. He has no time for myths, mysticism, or mysteries. The dead stay dead, and only idiots believe otherwise. Yet from time to time he thinks that he hears something moving restlessly in the cremator. If he hears anything at all, it must be only the elements of the furnace still cooling off from the fiery work it has done. His state of mind can be explained by the dreariness of this windowless bunker far beneath the city, where his phone won't work and where there is no one to bend a knee to him. All his life he has been a man of the people. Without people to serve him and fear him and acknowledge by their respect that he's the capo di tutti capi, he feels smaller and vulnerable. He's brought the armchair here so that he can maintain a watch on the cremator. The door is latched, and of course, it can't be opened from inside. Yet sometimes when his attention is on the cheese or the beef or the wine or on his wristwatch, he thinks he hears the latch rattling. Each time he looks up, the latch handle isn't moving, and the noise stops. He's eating too much and drinking too much, but he isn't able to sleep, and there's nothing else to do. Drafts of an inexplicable source cause the candle flames to dance. Shadows crawl the walls. His sons will come for him in the morning. They are reliable boys. They will come for him because they know what's good for them. 28. Shortly past 1 o'clock in the morning, the wind unwinds, and silence settles on the blanketed city. The last flakes of snow are drawn slowly to the earth by nothing more than gravity. When dawn breaks, the rising sun reveals a weather condition that meteorologists call severe clear, with not a shred of clouds, the air crystalline, the sky as blue as it has ever been. Atop the chain-link fence, the coils of razor wire are crusted in glittering ice that gives them a festive, decorative quality. The formidable concrete building, where hazardous medical waste is supposedly detoxified, stands windowless and fortress-like, as if designed as a refuge in the event of a zombie apocalypse. At 10:15 a.m., Patrick McGinty, who's the eldest son of Mickey, and whose company installs and services elevators in a few hundred high-rises, parks his restored vintage Hummer to the left of his father's Lincoln Aviator. At 10:22, Liam McGinty, the middle son and the owner of a company that leases specialty vehicles to government and private sector entities, arrives in a 600-horsepower Ford Velociraptor twin-turbo with six-wheel drive, jacked up on big tires. He parks to the right of the Aviator. Connor McGinty, the youngest son, is an investment fund manager who also supervises the state-run lottery and has sole fiduciary responsibility thereof. At 10:32, Connor arrives in an armored Rhino GX, the largest SUV currently on the market. The 20-inch-wide chain-wrapped tires rattle and clink across the concrete floor. Connor parks behind his father's Aviator. The brothers meet at the elevator, which Patrick has already discovered is no longer functioning. "The cab seems to be frozen at the bottom of the shaft." Liam says, "You're the elevator guy. Can you spring him?" "Sure, might take time, depending on the situation down there." "Whoever did this," Liam says, "they're really pissed at him." "More important," says Connor, "are they pissed at us?" When these men were at breakfast in their separate residences in the city's finest neighborhood, each received, simultaneously to the minute, a package delivered by drivers for something called Portentous Message Service, which turns out not to exist. Each of the thick envelopes contained copies of their parents' living trust, their old man's will, and their mother's will, to which the brothers have not heretofore been privy. Upon receipt of these documents, Patrick, Liam, and Connor retired to their respective home offices and locked the doors and engaged in an hour of the most intensive reading they have ever done. They've endured unpleasant surprises. Their father has left everything to their mother. Their mother has left each of them 5% of her estate, and 85% goes to their sister, Angelica McGinty Coleridge. Angelica, currently the Attorney General of Florida, is married to the Ambassador to the United Nations, and she aspires to be a United States Senator. The package also contains a non-disclosure agreement signed by Angelica, specifying the terms of her parents' wills and requiring her not to reveal them to anyone. Clearly, Mom and Dad have taken stock of their four children and have bet all their chips on their only daughter. This is most distressing to Patrick, Liam, and Connor, not only because they are out more than $130 million each, but also because their parents are, through offshore shell companies, equal partners in each brother's business. Those interests will also be inherited by Angelica. The brothers have little affection for their sister. She was always their parents' favorite, treated like a princess. She's a greedy, conniving narcissist. Of all the siblings, she's the most like Mickey, and is in fact more Mickey than Mickey himself. They know what that portends. Being under her thumb, which is where she will keep them, will be infuriating. A waking nightmare. With the living trust and the other documents, Portentous Message Service included an unsigned advisory on a plain sheet of paper that simply stated this: "He lives below the city where he belongs, with no way out by his own hand. Consider the benefits." The benefits are numerous and obvious. The big negative is that without their father, the protection that he provides to his children's businesses will fade when someone else wrests control of his political machine and rules the city. Now Patrick reveals that he has long been weary of the tension that is inevitable when at all times he has to fear that one day the FBI might be set free to investigate the McGinty machine and come for the entire family. Dad depends on his friends in Washington to block any prosecutor who maybe draws a bead on him. And us.
Dad doesn't have any friends, Connor says. What he has is co-conspirators. Calls them his angels.
Liam says, on Earth even angels die or rat you out. Seems like someone turned on him.
Big time, Patrick agrees.
But they don't want war with us. They're giving us a way out. If I could have the inheritance I deserve and cash out of my business, I'd retire with peace of mind, live in Lake Tahoe during the summer, maybe La Jolla in the winter, just Heather and me, now that all the kids are done with college.
Early retirement from political corruption also appeals to Liam, a confirmed bachelor.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to be done with all this stress. Maybe move to Nevada, get into a legitimate business like pornography.
High profit margin, Patrick says, plus a steady supply of hot young chicks, which is better than most other fringe benefits.
What about you, Connor? What's your dream?
Well, you know I love to cook.
You're a damn good cook, Liam says.
I think it'd be lovely to own a fine but unpretentious restaurant in a tourist town like maybe Newport Beach, maybe Palm Springs.
Dad wouldn't understand that. He never understood me the way you do.
He'd break your legs if he understood you, says Liam.
Patrick agrees.
Actually, he'd probably kill you. He was clueless about a lot of things.
He was, Liam agrees. He was clueless.
Connor says, I'd like to buy a dog.
Dogs are the best, Liam says.
Buy a dog, find a husband I love, and settle down to a quiet life, Connor says.
Liam and Patrick are deeply touched by this domestic vision. They aren't surprised or offended by Connor's sexual orientation. He is the kindest member of the family, the favorite of everyone except his parents. This urgent conference has become a bonding experience. But by their upbringing, the brothers aren't huggers. They hug, and almost tearfully pledge undying fealty during all that is to come. The easiest thing will be to remove the GPS from the old man's aviator so that the car can't be tracked. Then it can be driven to a salvage yard and compacted into a 4-foot square cube. For many years, this strange building has been owned by the old man through a corporation on Grand Cayman Island. Following Angelica McGinty Coleridge's tragic passing, however that might be arranged, and after their mother has revised her will, the property will be part of the brothers' inheritance, never to be developed, forever locked securely. Inevitably, their mother will be depressed by the disappearance of her devoted husband, a la Jimmy Hoffa, and the untimely death of her daughter. However, there are countless remedies for depression, and she will certainly choose one when the time is right. In all, the brothers expect to be settled in their new and stress-free lives within 10 months, maybe 8, if not 6. It's a common belief, folk wisdom, the tragedies come in threes. With careful planning, the loss of a father, sister, and mother in rapid order can be made to seem like no more than a confirmation of that old adage. Now at the inoperative elevator, the three men hug again, Connor says, I'm afraid I'll think of him down there alone. Mickey and Samantha McGinty are not in the least sentimental, and they have taught their children that to indulge in such fuzzy feelings is a dangerous weakness. Consequently, Liam says a bit too sharply, he's not alone, he's got Wooten.
That's worse than just alone, Patrick laments.
I wish it wasn't necessary, but it is what it is. He never should have started selling guns to the gangs, even to terrorists.
Liam agrees. Arming people like them is a dirty business. I was never for it.
Me either, Patrick says. Dad liked playing a revolutionary.
Well, he never was one, Connor says. And the guns were just wrong.
Arming people like them is a dirty, dirty business, Liam repeats with new emphasis.
And there isn't much money in it, Patrick says. Not when you compare it to other income streams.
He won't starve, says Liam. He's got like 30 years of food down there.
Patrick shakes his head. If it's 30, then with Wooten, it's 15 years.
30, Liam insists.
And after a moment of consideration, no one disagrees with him.
And if he gets bored being alone, says Patrick, there's a large library, a few thousand books.
But he never was much of a reader, Connor says.
Liam puts an arm around his little brother's shoulders. He may discover a new love for literature.
In fact, I'd bet on it.
Well, Connor says, if not, he's also got the guns.
He does, that's right. He's got more guns than he needs.
29. 2 days later, the man with no name uses a forged driver's license that Ace of Diamonds has provided and pays cash in advance to book a room for 1 week in a 3-star family-run motel nestled among whispering palm trees. That night he sleeps deeply, as usual. When he wakes suddenly near dawn, he is in tears, which has never happened before. If he ever dreams, he remembers nothing of those unconscious dramas. He senses that in the dream he suffered some great loss, but he knows not what it might have been. He wonders if a loss of like kind might lie in his past, beyond the wall of engineered amnesia. He has lunch on a restaurant terrace at water's edge. The sea is a field of glimmering sapphires and emeralds, and the low surf breaks in a white lace of foam on a golden beach. The check for lunch, including two beers, is $32.55. His waitress, a cheerful redhead, regards him with a gimlet eye when he gives her $300 and tells her to keep the change. She says, "I have a husband, two kids, and no regrets." "I don't mean anything by it. I tip everyone like this."
"Why?"
"Why not?
Are you rich or something?"
"Not that I'm aware," he says truthfully. "But whenever I need money, it's always there."
She says, "I could use a magic lamp like that."
The mysterious figure Ace has provided him with $40,000 in a secret compartment in the Ford Explorer that he drove south from the city. The money is meant to ease his way through the period of restoration between assignments. As he finishes the last of his beer, Nameless wonders where young Jim Freeman and his mother will be resettled. Perhaps one day he will visit them. He imagines saying, "You need a father, Jim, and I need a son, and I can't imagine I could ever have a better one than you." That thought surprises him. He wonders about the inspiration for it. He suspects it might be a fragment from his unremembered dream of the previous night, because it has the flavor of fantasy and is nothing he is likely to have a chance to say in real life. From the restaurant, he wanders through a warren of seaside shops and galleries, which is when he sees the couple who rivet his attention. She is lovely, with a gamine smile. Her companion is a 20-something surfer type. They're tanned and fit, but it is not their appearance that he finds arresting. It is the tattoo. The man wears a tank top, and on his left biceps is a Triskelion similar to the one in the glimpse of a totalitarian future that Nameless had on his way to meet Jimmy at the abandoned grocery. A circle enclosing three muscular red arms that are joined at the shoulder, bent at the elbow, hands fisted, forming a wheel. The most common form of a Triskelion is one with three running legs, which is the device of Sicily in the Isle of Man. Nameless has never seen this one anywhere else but in his vision. For a few minutes he follows the couple, but nothing about them seems suspicious, certainly not ominous. Intuition warns him not to ask the man what the Triskelion means to him. If this is a symbol of some organization that might become the focus of a future mission, he should not now call himself to their attention. In a bookshop he buys a novel. Reading is his favorite way to pass the time between missions. He has no one to call, no family or friends with whom to rendezvous. The people with whom he works are a mystery to him, and though he has met some of them on his missions, he doesn't know their real names. He is alone, but he suspects that he is alone by choice, for he is not lonely in his isolation. Being alone feels right, as if by some fateful act he has earned a future as a solitary man, and would be wrong to want anything else. As mysterious as our Ace of Diamonds and the others with whom Nameless works, so he is no less mysterious to himself. But perhaps that is the condition of all men and women in this strange and troubled world.